We're going to hear four bills. We are not going to hear House Bill 2254 because that can be carried over as a House bill. The Senate committee will close down today. The House bill can wait. It needs an amendment anyway. We're waiting for certain people to be here at certain times, and so I think we will. Okay, what the plan is, we're going to do the medical marijuana last, and I'm hoping we can get through these other bills fairly quickly. We were going to do Senate 26, but we have to wait for a few minutes for that. So we will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 973. Yeah. Do you want to give a...
Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 973.
Senate Bill 973, in your packet, you have with you the dash two amendments. We've heard this bill before. The dash two amendments basically replace the bill. And what this does, and I will defer to the sponsor of the bill to provide more detail if necessary, is it does require a petition of a minor child up for adoption. That when the petitioner does file, they have to include statement containing full name and address of the child, petitioner, person with whom the child has lived during the last 5 years, and places where the child has lived at that period. During that period, if information is readily available and known to petitioner. And then any person not party to the proceedings who has physical custody of child or claims rights of legal custody or physical. It requires petitioner to serve the petition to the parents of a child's parents who are deceased or incapacitated, basically the grandparents, if the names and addresses are ascertained by the petitioner and defines the terms used in the bill. This does apply to adoptions filed on or after the effective date of the bill. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Martha Pellegrino, would you come up, please? And Kathy Ledesma. Yes, if you would come up. Oh, and Hans, as long as you're here, sit down.
Thank you, Senator.
Martha, would you like to lead off?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Martha Pellegrino. I am a third-year law student at the University of Oregon and an intern for Senator Brown this session. I'm just going to give you a big two-minute or two-sentence big picture overview that I think Rick just did. But the big picture, this bill does two things. It makes the pleading requirement in 109-309 consistent with the UCCJEA, which is the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction Enforcement Act, which is in ORS 109-767. The second thing it does is it slightly expands the requirement of who needs to receive notice of an adoption to include the parents of a deceased or incapacitated parent. So the dash two amendments beginning on page 2, line 25. The people who need to be included in a written statement in the pleadings of an adoption, it includes the child giving the names and permanent address, the petitioner. Line 30, going on to page 3, the persons with whom the child has lived during the last 5 years and the places where the child has lived during that period, if the names and addresses may be readily ascertained by the petitioner. Also, on page 3, lines 3 through 6, if known, any person not a party to the proceeding who has physical custody of the child or claims rights of legal custody or physical custody of or parenting time of visitation with the child. So that just includes, make sure that everybody who needs to be in the pleading so that the court knows, so the court may contact anybody significant to the adoption. The second part, in second major change, which includes notice, is on page 4, beginning in line 10, and this deals with who the petitioner needs to serve the petition to. So this exception is sub C applies to a very narrow case in which there's an adoption involving a deceased or incapacitated parent. What this does then is require service to the parent of that deceased or incapacitated parent. And then we define incapacity and meeting essential requirements as defined by the ORS. So those are the central changes. Are there any questions that you have that I could answer?
I want to hear from Ms. Ledesma.
Yeah, we will hear.
Okay.
Thank you. Hans, would you, you're representing Senator Brown's office.
Yes, thank you, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hans Bernard, Senator Brown's legislative aide. As you remember, we first brought this bill before the committee for the Johnson family that you heard from via phone. The bill was substantially too broad at that point. The Dash 1 amendments were an attempt to narrow it down, and after several discussions with many of the parties involved, Department of Human Services, members of the Family Law Section of the Oregon Bar, Senator Brown and her background as a family law attorney as well, we have crafted these amendments that Martha just outlined and feel that we have achieved the goals but have not significantly shifted the policy that was in place at the time. If you have questions, Martha is obviously the technical expert on this.
Thank you.
I do have prepared testimony for the record. My name is Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Adoption Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, as you will recall, DHS did oppose Senate Bill 973 in its original form for both fiscal and policy reasons. Senator Cruz's suggestion, we offered to work with the bill's sponsor, Kate Brown, Senator Brown, and others on the amendments that would alleviate these concerns while still meet the objectives of the bill's sponsor. We met on April 21st and very quickly reached consensus on changes that could be made to the original bill to satisfy all concerned. The changes include limiting the applicability of the resulting statute to the parent or parents of a deceased or incapacitated parent, not extending to relatives the ability to request a mediated agreement for post-adoption communication under ORS 109, and as you'll recall, that was one of our safety concerns that we had, Senator Cruz. And three, conforming the proposed legislation to the pleading requirements contained in the UCCJEA that was already mentioned this afternoon. With these changes, only in very rare circumstances would the statute created by Senate Bill 973 affect DHS or the families that we serve. We don't believe that would have any fiscal impact whatsoever on DHS. And moreover, when it does apply to a child for whom DHS is doing or is involved in adoption planning, the notification to the parent of the deceased or incapacitated parent of the child for whom that adoption planning is being done conforms to DHS's current policy and practice. This practice is based on ORS 125, in which DHS may, quote, be appointed guardian of a minor if the minor has no living parents and if no willing, qualified, and suitable relative or other person has petitioned the court for appointment as a guardian. DHS, in these circumstances, makes diligent efforts to locate and notify the relatives of the deceased parent of the child's whereabouts and include them in adoption planning for the child when that's appropriate. We really appreciate the opportunity to work with Senator Brown on this. Thank you, Senator Cruz, for suggesting that, and the other interested persons to create what we believe now is a good public policy that will help Oregon children who lose a parent through death or incapacity to not also have to lose beneficial contact with their extended family of the deceased or incapacitated parent. Therefore, we do support the bill. In talking this afternoon, there are a couple of tweaks that we would like to see made in the bill and think that we could probably accomplish those when they go on the other side, but we would strongly support that this bill be passed out of this committee. And I'd be glad to answer any of your questions.
Thank you. Questions?
No, Ms. Chair, I'm dissatisfied. I want to thank Senator Brown for being collaborative on this, and as I said at the first hearing, if you can make Kathy happy, I'll be happy, and so thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Robin Pope. Now, Richard Bayer, did you sign up for? Are you up here for this?
No.
No. Oh, okay. 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 That's fine. Just wanted to be sure.
Thank you, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. My name is Robin Pope. For the record, I'm an attorney who practices adoption law in the state of Oregon, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Standing Committee on Adoption. I have to apologize. I did not prepare written testimony today because I didn't see the amendments until around noon and drove down from Portland to be here. I am speaking on behalf of myself and not on behalf of my committee today because we haven't had time to actually process this, but I fully support the amendments that we've made. I was part of the work group with Kate Brown. I used to work with her as an attorney when she was in private practice, and the meeting went incredibly well last week. We just were able to say, yes, this is what we need to do, this is the policy, and let's get there, and we did. So I want to support this. I agree with Ms. Ledesma that we have a couple of little tweaks to make, and I'm going to mention just one, not that we have to do it right now. My concern, and I believe my colleague's concern, would be to make sure that when we're talking about the parent of the parent who has been deceased or incapacitated, we're talking about a parent with a legal relationship. We also have parents who are considered putative parents in the state of Oregon and putative grandparents who don't have a legal relationship with a child. And I would just like it clear that the intent of this bill is to continue legal relationships and to honor those even if a child or a parent dies or is incapacitated. And other than that modest tweak, and we had one other thing that we can work out, I know, I would fully support this bill as written, and I appreciate also, Senator Cruz, your suggestion that we work with Senator Brown.
What a guy.
What a guy.
Hey, it's a beautiful thing when it works.
It is.
Now, would you like to come back and help tweak the medical marijuana bill? I mean,
oh, sure.
Everything will fall into place. And, okay.
Thank you very much for your time today.
Let's do it.
Okay. Where's my gavel?
Oh, you stuck my gavel again.
You have to be careful of that guy. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 973.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 973.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 973. Any objection, discussion? So moved.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 973 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay, discussion. Seeing no discussion, would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Aye.
Senator Montana.
Excuse.
Senator Sean Stark.
Aye.
Chair Morissette.
Aye. Thank you.
That's taken care of?
Yeah, that takes care of it. Yes, Kate will. Senator Brown will carry the bill.
You'd be in trouble if you didn't.
And
so.
We will close the public hearing and close the work session and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 1026. Do we have anyone to testify on that?
No, we'd like to quickly review what we have.
Yes, would you please review the bill?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 1206 does require insurers that cover hospital medical expenses to also provide annual prostate cancer screening and digital rectal examinations. Studies tested for men who are age 50 and older and for men 50 and younger who are at risk, including African-American men and those with a family history. It establishes that all state-regulated carriers adhere to the Act. We do have the Dash 2 amendments in your packet. What these amendments do is changes to prostate cancer screening to either biannually or as determined by treating physicians. Right now, this is on an annual basis. This would be biannually or as determined by physician. And it also then deletes the, right now the bill is exempted from the automatic repeal on the sixth anniversary of the date. This would delete that exemption. So those are the two changes from the Dash 2. We did have a fiscal impact statement on the original version. I don't know if anybody from PEB is or Regents is here to testify on that amendment. Thank you, Chair.
Do we have a fiscal on the amended version?
No, Chair, I did not see it.
No. Senator Starr, would you like to speak to the bill?
Excuse me.
We don't have anyone signed up. So, Senator Starr, we will have the discussion.
Yes, I agreed to the
dash two amendments, which change it from annual to biennial.
Mm-hmm.
And I received information from my legislative assistant today that he secured from the internet regarding the cost, and that has been just now distributed to the members. If you look at the second page of that, indicates that the state of Massachusetts Division of Health Care Finance and Policy retained 11 Group to perform an actuarial assessment of four proposed bills, which somewhat parallel this bill.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Bill 926 is the closest if you look at the demographic area in the center portion of that. If you turn to the third page, indicates increased premium cost of 2 cents. Actuarial assessment. That's somewhat different than we had in testimony at our last hearing. We do not have a subsequent referral. I urge that we, in fact, move this bill to the floor for the due pass recommendation, and I would like to see us move it ahead.
Okay. Thank you. Actually, we could have closed the public hearing earlier. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session.
Senator Morissette, I'd like to move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1026.
Senator Metzger moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 1026. Discussion, objection, seeing none, so moved.
Senator Morissette, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1026 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Metzger moves Senate Bill 1026 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Curry?
Excuse.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Monica
Anderson?
No. Senator Charles Stark?
Aye.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. So moved. Senator Starr, would you carry our bill?
Thank you. I would be glad to carry our bill.
Thank you. Okay, the next bill that we are going to hear is Senate Bill 329, and we do have a few people signed up to testify. Okay, so we will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 329. Yes, please briefly describe.
Thank you, Chair. We do have we've heard this bill before. Senate Bill 329 does expand the Oregon Prescription Drugs Program, which is basically a bulk purchasing program for prescription drugs. We have the dash three amendments from the proponents of the bill. What the dash three amendments do is to expand eligibility for this program for people up to a gross income of 300% of the federal poverty level. It does allow enrollees in health benefit plans up to a maximum enrollment of 250,000 people. The Department of Administrative Services through the Oregon Health Policy Research Office can also establish a waiting list for this program and periodically open it up for enrollment. And this does also still contain the other provisions of the original bill. Basically changes some of the 6-month waiting period criterion. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Bruce Goldberg, would you come up, please? You're somewhere in the room. Maybe not. Okay. Kathy Carpinian. Kathy Carpinian, would you come up? And Shannon Callahan, are you in the room? Shannon Callahan, would you come up, please? And Rick Bennett, would you come up, please? Thank you. goal. Okay, we'll, Kathy, would you
sure.
start?
My name is Kathy Carpenin. I've just recently moved from Beaverton to Forest Grove. About a year ago, my husband lost his job of 30 years, and we became uninsured because we couldn't pay the COBRA premium of $748 a month. At that time, my prescriptions were running retail about $1,200 a month, and that was before I added another one. I added it last July, and my husband's were running over $400. As a result, as we've run out of prescriptions, we haven't refilled them. I feel that it's important to open up the pool because I'm only 51. My husband would qualify, but I do not. And I'm the one that uses the bulk of the prescriptions in the household and would really benefit by passage of this bill and by opening it up to more people.
Thank you. Shannon.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Callahan, and I'm a staff attorney and consumer advocate with the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, a nonprofit, nonpartisan group in Oregon with over 33,000 members. I'm here today to urge you to support Senate Bill 329-3 amendments, which would allow more Oregonians to enter the Oregon Drug Prescription Program created by the legislature in 2003. The bill does increase eligibility by allowing individuals whose income does not exceed 300% of the poverty level to enroll. It would also allow 250,000 Oregonians who are currently under a private health plan to enroll in the program. We would also say that undoubtedly the expansion of the program is a great thing. We would submit that the program should actually be available to all 780,000 Oregonians currently lacking prescription drug coverage. These Oregonians who lack drug coverage are forced to make difficult decisions between their medications and other life necessities such as food and rent. Some are putting their health in jeopardy by skipping doses, by splitting doses, or completely going up, going without their necessary medications because prescription drugs are simply just too expensive. Currently, the Oregon Drug Prescription Program is estimating that members are saving approximately 30% on prescription drugs on average and up to 60% on generic drugs. Increasing membership in this pool will only serve to increase the cost savings for all entities and individuals in the program. Senate Bill 329-3 amendments will help Oregonians struggling with the rising costs of needed medications. However, this pool should further be expanded to maximize the bargaining power of the pool and improve prescription access for all Oregonians. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Thank you. Rick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Rick Bennett representing AARP Oregon. Previously testified in support of Senate Bill 329. Just want to indicate that we also support the Dash 3 amendment. AARP has recently surveyed our members here in Oregon. We have over 460,000 members. That's individuals 50 years old and older. And we have surveyed our members in the state on a variety of issues, including prescription drugs and specifically this program. Now, we haven't released the results related to prescription drugs yet. We will do so in the next week or two, but I just want to let you know that the results indicate very strong support for the state of Oregon doing something more about making prescription drugs more affordable and specifically expanding the criteria or changing the criteria in this program to allow more people to participate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Jim Gardner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers Association. I'm not going to repeat the testimony that I delivered last time in opposition to this bill. It is essentially the same, but I want to stress 2 points. Mm-hmm. The first is that we are not unsympathetic to the problem of people without insurance who lack access and the means to pay for prescription drugs. And it is for that reason that under the industry-operated prescription assistance program, we are currently serving approximately 100,000 Oregonians with free drugs, not reduced-price drugs, but free drugs, with an average of 2.2 prescriptions per participant in that program. We have recently launched, as I think some members of the committee are aware, an aggressive effort effort to improve access to that, to facilitate through a new and improved website and other means, and we're experiencing right now a fairly robust growth in enrollment in the free drug program. In addition to that, there is a consortium of a number of the largest companies who have a program called Together RX, which offers discounts substantially in excess of those which are available from the state-run government-run pool. So our money is where our mouth is in terms of taking concrete steps to get, number one, free drugs to people who need them, and number two, discounted drugs to lower-income people. We'd prefer to build on that and have this program operate within its existing parameters. One thing that I want to point out to the committee, which strikes me as a little curious, is that on page 3, lines 6 through 7 of the -3 amendments, expansion population there are people who are already covered by health care insurance. They're people that have a policy with Blue Cross or Regents or Kaiser or whatever. These are people that have coverage. They're not uninsured. They are insured people. So it's a little it's a little curious to my way of thinking that people with insurance coverage are being brought into a pool that's designed to make access to prescription drugs better for the uninsured. I just point that out for purposes of clarity. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thanks. Bruce Goldberg, would you come up, please?
Yes. Senator Morissette, members of the committee, Bruce Goldberg, Office of Health Policy, here to talk to you in favor of Senate Bill 329. I had come before you about a month ago, so I will try not to be repetitive. I believe that what I said then is still true today, which is that there are 600,000 people in this state who have no health insurance coverage, who need help with access to medical care and low-cost prescription drugs. And in addition, actually to speak directly to Mr. Gardner's last remark, we have rising health insurance costs as the greatest issue facing our businesses in our state today, and the need for relief for our businesses to be able to provide a full and comprehensive health care benefit to their workers at a price that they can afford. What this bill does is both things. It helps provide prescription drug price relief for low-income individuals, and what it helps do is provide prescription drug price relief for businesses that are struggling to make their payrolls and who would like to continue to offer comprehensive health benefits for their workers. And what this bill does is allow them to pull their purchasing power so that businesses can pull their purchasing power together. We can use that purchasing power to help afford to buy lower cost prescription drugs for those individuals who are paying out of pocket. So let me end my remarks there. You have a vehicle in front of you today to do both those things. You know, by expanding this program, you can offer everybody who needs it substantial discounts for prescription drugs. You can help Oregon's businesses, and you can help citizens who need to be able to afford prescription drugs. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Lynn Lindquist. Would you please come up?
Now I'll call you.
Okay. Now I'll call Tim. Yeah. You know this person.
Thank you, Sharon. We're set. Lynn Lundquist, President of the Oregon Business Association. I'll be very brief. all of you members of the panel know this issue, and in fact much better than I do. I'm here just simply to make a few very brief comments. As you well know, healthcare costs are a real issue to businesses throughout the state. Mm-hmm. And certainly prescription drugs are a major driver of that. As we try to make sure that we to in every way possible offer health care to our employees, it certainly is a driver of our insurance costs, as we have, as what has happened in the prescription drug, as well as all healthcare areas. So I'm here today simply saying, first of all, I think we ought to be recognize that what pharma's already done, and we should not let that go unnoticed, because they've helped significantly our state, and I think that needs to be said. Having said that, we still are interested in keeping our employees healthy and our profit as on the pausing side as well. So this would be one endeavor that would help us in that, to simply continue our health insurance and everywhere we can, so that we can continue to be the economic drivers of the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Appreciate your comments. Tim Nesbitt, Mary Beth Healy, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO's, appearing in support of the bill with the Dash 3 amendments, very much in line with what you heard from Dr. Goldberg. I want to state that as important as it is to cover the uninsured and help them be able to afford medications, it's just as important, we think, to help those with insurance and the employers who are struggling to hold on to that insurance. If we don't, we're going to see an even greater increase in the number of uninsured in Oregon as employer-sponsored health care becomes less and less affordable. One way to do that is simply to invite private employers and their health plans to the table. You're not mandating anything here. And, in fact, you're not guaranteeing anything. All you're saying is, if you think you can do better by combining your purchasing power with ours in this prescription drug bulk purchasing pool, you're invited. I guess the Dash 3 amendments say, in effect, you're invited on a first-come, first-served basis, because you're going to cut it off at $250,000, all the better to kind of issue the call and encourage those who are suffering from the highest costs to come join the pool and work to bargain for a best price for these all-important products. So we very much appreciate the step forward that this will represent in terms of the Oregon prescription drug purchasing program. And I just want to ask one clarifying question for the record. My understanding is that the amendments would cover private sector plans, whether they're traditional plans, whether they're Taft-Hartley trusts, or whether they're self-insured plans. And that's my understanding. I'm just hoping that that's my reading of correct reading of the bill.
Chair, I'm attached to your staff member summary are the statutes that are referenced in the bill. For further clarification, you may want to call up Dr. Goldberg.
Dr. Goldberg, can you help us out? Did you hear the question?
Chair Morissette, I did. For the record, I think what I can say is that was certainly the intent.
Okay. Thank you. We very much appreciate the progress represented by these amendments. Thank you.
Ms. Healy.
Thank you, Senator. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, excuse me, for the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy, and I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. We, too, have been here before testifying in support of 329 and are happy to be here supporting the Dash 3 amendments. Each day, as you know, we bring you the Daily Dose, which profiles an Oregonian story and their struggles around the high cost of health care. I'd like to draw your attention to today's Daily Dose. Can you give me a favor? Bring that to Brittany. Thank you so much. And it's from a woman whose fiance was unable to afford his blood pressure medication and unfortunately passed away. And it just, I think, he was 50 years old, and I think it's just an indication that the high cost of health care and prescription drugs in particular can have great impacts on people's lives. And I think that if this family were here today, they would encourage you to expand this pool, which, as you know, we worked on last
last session were very excited about this, and I wanted to share a story of a call we got in the office the other day from a family out in Baker City who got their Oregon Prescription Drug Program card. They were thrilled. They filled 3 prescriptions. They saved 40% on their medications. And, you know, as a treat for them, because they are on a very tight income, they went and spent their money in the local community, went and got a milkshake and a burger at the local Dairy Queen. So I think it shows that if people are saving money on their prescription drugs, they can help drive economic prosperity in their local communities. And that's another piece of this program that will be very helpful for individuals, for spurring economic development, and saving people money. You know, you've heard testimony from great people today, and I would just urge you to pass this very important bill.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you. One more. Jay Abode. Jay Abode. Okay. We need to back.
Question? You call him back?
Yeah. Okay. We're going to close the public hearing. Stand at ease for just a moment. While we're waiting for another member, we could go ahead and open the beginning of the public hearing on Senate Bill 772, and we can have the introduction and so on, and then when we can close that public hearing and come back to the work session that we're going to have on the other bill. So let's go ahead and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 772, which we will close as soon as someone comes in the door so we can do this other thing and get back to this. So, but we don't want to sit around any longer than possible.
To describe the package.
How would you describe the amendments?
Thank you, Chair. In your attached to your staff measure summary is a bulleted description of the dash two amendments to 772. And basically what I did was very quickly go through and indicated on which page.
We're going to close the public hearing. Close the public hearing on 772.
Welcome.
And we're going to
give a star.
And we're going to open the work session on Senate Bill 329 with the dash three amendments. That's where we're starting.
Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Okay. Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Chair, I would like to move the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 329.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 329. Questions? Concerns? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 329 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended.
Okay. Senator Montes Anderson moves Senate Bill 329 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Senator Metzger?
Aye.
Senator Montes Anderson?
Aye.
Senator Charles Starr?
No.
Chair Morissette?
Aye. Senate Bill 329 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair, should notice a potential minority report.
I was anticipating you.
Thank you very much.
I will carry the bill. Senator Cruz serves notice of a possible minority report. Very good. Thank you. We will close the work on 329. And we will now reopen the work session that we left. Do you remember where you were exactly when we closed it? You have to start out from there.
Public hearing.
We will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 772.
Okay. Thank you. As I was saying, you do have a bulleted two-page list of generally what the amendments do. And then also in your packet is a semi-engrossed version of the bill, just showing you what was deleted. And it's not fully engrossed, since most of the sections are added toward the end of the bill. So I will just briefly go over this bulleted list. Page 1 of the amendments does delete the current Section 1 of the bill. And Section 1 of the bill, in the original bill, did indicate the number of plants, number of ounces of marijuana a user could have. It didn't require DHS to list the registry card whether the individual chose to possess 7 ounces or the amount designated for one crop. It does delete the section that established a multi-person growth site. And then it does delete the section that regarding a seedling of plant. What it does then do, starting on page 1, it does add a new section 1 that defines grow site, defines definition of delivery, and defines marijuana grow site. On page 3, it then adds a new section 2 that does remove some of the language regarding ounces and plants a cardholder can possess, and then established that under certain circumstances the affirmative defense can be established. And then back on page 3 it does establish again in this, and I think the drafter did go ahead and remove some sections and add other sections just for a cleaner copy and flow of the bill. So as some things were deleted in earlier sections, it was added in later on. So page 3, the new section does add back that a definition of a seedling or start plant has no flowers, is less than 12 inches in height, 12 inches in diameter. Page 4 adds a new section 3 that requires the DHS registry of medical marijuana users to include a written statement as to whether the marijuana will be produced at a location where the cardholder or caregiver are present, or another location that is either an annual or a year-round grow site, which is novel and brand new to the bill and described later. On page 8, the bill then basically just renumbers the remaining sections of the bill that were left in, and I will not go back over those, but it's information that we covered at the first hearing. On page 8 and 9, there's new sections added to the bill that requires DHS to establish a marijuana grow site registration system for cardholders, requires information to include the name, address of grow site, cardholder's number, declaration of site is annual or year-round, and other information that DHS feels necessary. And it requires a marijuana grow site card to be displayed at site at all times when marijuana is being grown, and one card for each card holder for which the marijuana is being grown. So at this growth site, there would have to be a card displayed. Probably key to the bill is in those sections in page 9 to 11. And you'll note that there are some blanks in the bill germane to the number of ounces of usable marijuana. And I think Senator Chair Morissette is going to talk a little bit more about information he's going to be looking for. But basically, on pages 9 to 11 in those sections, it does require the cardholder or to provide a statement to DHS if the marijuana is being produced at the present location or another location. It does establish that the cardholder is using either an annual grow site, and that site cannot exceed 20 mature plants or up to X number of usable ounces of marijuana, or that if the site is year-round, and that a year-round grow site cannot exceed 7 mature plants, and then again, yet to be determined an ounce of usable marijuana. The same criterion apply to someone who's growing for another person, in essence, a grower for, and again, that person can only grow up to 28 mature plants and X number of usable marijuanas, ounces of marijuana, and the same for year-round site. At a annual grow site, a person may only produce marijuana for up to 4 card holders. So again, there's the annual site, 4 card holders. An annual site, they have to start growing at the same time of year. And when they do harvest the marijuana, it must be returned in full to the user, plus the registration card. So the card is at the site where the marijuana is being grown, and the card and all the harvested marijuana must go back to the card holder. Anybody with an annual grow site may not assert the affirmative defense. On a year-round site, a person may produce marijuana for up to 2 card holders. Again, this is a grower who's growing for someone else, and they can do for just 2 card holders, and they may assert the affirmative defense. Chair, that is very briefly what the amendments do. Thank you.
What we tried to do, and there were 4 of us who worked on this, basically 4, 3 senators and a representative, Senator Cruz, Senator Pozanski, myself, and Representative Steve March. We met a number of times and had some things drafted, and we were not able to resolve the amount of marijuana that the patient may have at a time. That was a difficult thing to do. So if it is going to belong to the patient and it will be delivered to the patient, then we weren't able to come up with a number, which is one of the things that we're looking for help on. The other thing has also to do with the year-round grow. If the person is growing it themselves, I don't see a problem there, but if there is a grower for the year-round grow, then the same thing is true. And when that is delivered to the patient, then it's going to be more than the current law allows, and we're going to have to figure out how much that is. The other thing that I think may be somewhat controversial is the reduction of number of patients that a particular grower may work with. I think it's 7 now, and that no 6.
No, it's no limit right now.
What? No limit. Well, we're limiting it according to this. Okay, according to this, there's a limit. Now, there are a number of things that have to be discussed, and this bill has 3 possibilities. We will hear some testimony, go back and work on it some more, and come back, have a work session, pass out a bill, or we will send it to Judiciary Committee after we get the details worked out, and they will basically have a work session, perhaps a public hearing, but a work session. But we want to keep people plugged into where we are, or we will run out of time and nothing's going to happen. So there are those possibilities, and some of you may think it's better to run out of time. I don't know. But we are trying to make it a better bill as far as the patients are concerned, to give them more control over. Senator Pazansky, would you like to come up here? Are you going to be here for a few minutes? Okay. Okay. Well, we just went through the amendments, and I was just explaining some of the difficulties we're having. But law enforcement has some concerns also, and we're trying to address some of those concerns as well, realizing that if we want to get a bill through this building, we have to take into account the needs of both sides and so on. And there is no perfect bill, and I don't think we're going to solve the entire issue this session, obviously not. So this is going to be an ongoing thing that we do have to address. I will say that I found out recently that Senate, our representative Jeff Krupp, had a bill in 01 that I think is a great idea, and that is to have a central grow site. I don't know if you're aware of that bill. You probably are. And that's something that he floated, and it didn't pass. I don't know if they took into consideration the amount of reserve that you have in your pot. The amount of reserve that you have to fund a central grow site, and that, I think, could solve some problems, because obviously there would not be a multiple group of suppliers out there. I would like to look at that in greater detail as we go along. So anyway, that's where we are there. And again, the blanks in here are basically on how much marijuana can be delivered to the patients, because it belongs to them. And so we're going to have to make some decisions, realizing that there's different potency, there's different needs, and all of that stuff. And I don't know how we come up with a perfect decision, but it's something we are attempting to do. So with that, okay, Leland Bayer Bridger. Laird. And Richard. Yeah. Okay. Part of it is my ineptness at reading names, and part of it is your lousy handwriting. So
we're all trying to be doctors.
Do you want to go first?
Who wants to start out? Come on.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Laird Funk. I live in Williams, Oregon, and I've been dealing with the medical marijuana issue for a long time, and I hope we might have solved it this session. I want to thank you for your work. Mm-hmm. I think the bill has got some good structure to it. I don't think it's the time to think about adding other issues or other approaches to other problems we might find, because, you know, like you say, we might just run out of time if we keep trying to change it around.
Yeah.
I think there are some problems I have, oddly enough, they are with plant numbers and the number of patients per garden site.
Okay.
The number of 28 plants as spoken to in this bill, if you limit the garden to the four persons on an annual basis, then that would imply the state of Oregon is happy to have 112 marijuana plants at any given site. Now, I personally don't have a problem with it, but I'd far rather see, sir, those 112 marijuana plants spread out among 16 patients, giving each seven. Seven plants has got a number that has some history in this bill. Some of the proposals to this committee included simply making the number seven plants instead of mature versus immature. I personally, frankly, sir, I have a real fear that 28 plants might just not be understandable to enough persons anywhere to make this bill passable. But so what I would suggest specifically, since no one has written amendments or written testimony, I'm going to give some concise suggestions using page and line number to the amendments, if that's permissible. Regarding patient numbers, on page 11, lines 11 and 12, that limits the annual grow to four patients, the year-round grow to two patients, and those are numbers which are absolutely crippling to the ability to supply medical marijuana to the people who need it. I would suggest that the original number of 7 in 772 just was a good number. And if we want to increase the number for outdoor growers a little bit, I would support that. But I personally get nervous when I see 28.
Now, excuse me.
Nervous. The patient numbers. Excuse me. I was talking about patient numbers. I just went to 28 plants. The patient numbers are 4 for the annual grow and 2 for the year-round. Yeah. And those are both too small. I would go for 7 indoors and perhaps some increase above 7 for an outdoor. But, again, I'm going to keep pushing.
Well, wait a minute. Now, I think what we're talking about for the annual grow is a single growing season period.
Right. So okay. Now, for a growing season per year. Oh, excuse me.
Oh no, that's fine. But let me say this. So what we're that would be how large? Okay, what's the number for an outdoor? How many people would you recommend for an outdoor grow with 28 plants?
I would say for an outdoor grow, the numbers of patients, the number that is in 772 would be adequate. The 7. That addresses the patient numbers, as far as I can see. 7 indoors, 7 outdoors. The plant numbers are a real problem again. 28 plants for 4 patients outdoors.
No, 28 plants each.
Excuse me? 28 plants per patient.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. If you allowed 4 patients outdoors, you have 28 plants. Again, that's 112 plants.
Yeah.
I say we need to limit the number of plants, again, to somewhat smaller than 28, slightly above 7, pick a number, and we need to add for the limits. You talk about to plug these holes up. I think addressing the limits for possession by addressing ounces per plant is a mistake. We should just say if you have an outdoor grow, you can possess these many pounds at the end of the thing or these many ounces, and if you have a year-round indoor grow, you can possess a certain number not related to plants.
So what would you recommend as the total number of ounces, pounds for that a patient would receive as a result of growing 28 plants on an annual grow? How much would be
I'm
delivered?
I'm just going to say for an annual grow, and again, I'm not liking 28 plants, for an annual grow, an amount that would be usable for me and adequate for most folks perhaps is 4 pounds. And for a continuing year-round grow indoors, I would suggest that the total number per harvest might be suitable at 1 pound. I think that's the end of the thrust of my comments, because I had concerns again about primarily patient numbers and plant numbers.
Okay.
And other people have some concerns about other parts. But
yeah, we talked about as high as 80 ounces or 5 mm-hmm. pounds or whatever.
Right.
You know, I mean, we didn't know where to go. Understanding that there are different needs for different people and there are different potencies and so on, it was really hard to come up with numbers, and that's kind of what we want to get a sense
right.
of.
I understand that.
So I appreciate you commenting on
I tried on to be that. Concise. And
yeah.
just, I think just as a general rule, I would shy away from tying the amount that one could possess with the number of plants one had, because there's no need to do that.
Okay. What you're talking about is the production, the end result.
Right. Right. And you've approached it in this bill by saying, leave a blank for how many ounces per plant. I would just say, forget the number of plants you're talking about for the possession amounts and just say you have 4 pounds for outdoors, 1 pound for indoors, and separate it from the plant number totally.
Let me understand. So a patient that is relying on a single annual grow
yes.
of 28 plants, you're recommending 4 pounds for the year.
I would recommend 4 pounds be seen as a reasonable amount for a patient for a year, regardless of whether the number
okay.
of plants it derived from was 28 or 7 or 8.
I see. Okay. That helps. I mean, that gives us another dimension
right.
because we were not, we didn't think of it in those terms necessarily.
I would find personally that to be an easier thing to think of as a patient,
mm-hmm.
and I think the law enforcement might like that number, I mean that approach better. I can't speak for them. I'm sure they will.
Would you like to speak for them?
Only if Frank can give me his money.
Good. Thank
so
you very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Who wants to go next?
My name is Rick Baer. I'm an internal medicine doctor, and I thank you for allowing me to testify. As you know, we just got the amendments this afternoon. Laird, Lee, Seville, and I, several of us have talked about it, and there are a couple areas of concern, primarily the same as Laird's. I'm a little confused about this because it removes the word immature, but it also talks about the word mature in here, and I think that having the word mature in here is very confusing. For example, on page 4, it says the rule shall provide that a plant that has no flowers and is less than 12 inches in height and less than 12 inches in diameter is a seedling or a start and not a mature plant. I think having the word in there mature is confusing because it sounds like we're trying to get rid of the immature distinction. And if you're going to make something less than 12 ounces an immature plant, then I'm not sure how that's going to fit. In other words, if you still have 7 plants and you can only have 4 immature plants, then how is that helping the patient by counting their clones as immature plants? They're already counted as immature plants even before this. Okay. So I think the word mature is confusing.
Now, maybe I'm wrong, but if you're growing indoors for yourself, say, don't you have plants at different stages of development?
Right. You do have plants at different stages of development. And the health department under the Oregon Medical Marijuana Act was assigned to differentiate between mature and immature. But when I read through this, it looks like there's an attempt to get beyond mature and immature and just count the plants. But when I look at the definition on page 4, line 3, they're still talking about a start or a seedling not being a mature plant. And I wanted to explain to you the trap that we don't want to fall into here is we don't want the start or the seedling to just be considered another immature plant and then nothing changes because the patient will still get called into court as having an immature plant. Possibly, if the word mature is left in here. I mean, if it says mature, then it presumes there's something called immature. I mean, to me, logically. And I think if you took a Microsoft Word and edited out all the words mature, I think you'd have a more clear document, in my opinion. Because then there would just be plants and starters.
Let me ask my assistant a question. Is legislative counsel listening to this? I'm sure he is. I hope so.
Jared Hansen's check.
Now, would you please call legislative counsel just to be sure, because we meet with legislative counsel, and I should have invited him here, but I'm assuming he's listening, because these are the kinds of things that he is struggling with as well. And And that's a good point, and I think that we need to take a look at that. Okay.
Thank you. I've only got a few other points because Laird Funk has covered these, but also at the same spot it talks about how a seedling or a starter may be possessed in any number. And as I recall from the previous hearing, the chair of the State District Attorneys Association said, oh, well, you can have 1,000,000. Well, I don't think patients need to have a million starters, and I think this number, if law enforcement wanted to see it at, say, 14 or something like that, because we're presuming that half the clones are going to die before they mature, so this doesn't need to be unlimited. This could probably be 14, limited to 14 starters or seedlings per patient.
Okay.
Instead of an unlimited number, if that would increase the chance of this getting through the building. Okay? I mean, that's just one of those things that I don't think any grower here anticipates getting an unlimited number of starter plants, and that just might grease the skids a little bit.
Okay.
Other than that, as Laird mentioned, the possession amounts are not adequate. I agree. I think that the year-round grow should be in the neighborhood of 7 plants in 1 pound, whereas the annual grow should be in the neighborhood of about 10 plants in 4 pounds. It's basically what what Laird is saying. Now, there are patients who use more than 4 pounds per year, but my understanding is they're like the federal patients that get their medical marijuana from the federal government. They use 6 pounds per year, but from things I've been able to read on forums and talk to patients, that 4 pounds per year would probably be, I don't know, 95 to 99% of patients, and that would be a good number. My only other comments after that is, of course, the multiple garden is not adequate. Having two people on an indoor and four people on an outdoor, the whole concept here is to try to gain some economy of scale so that we can share production costs and electricity costs and so forth like yeah. that. And I think it needs to go back to seven patients. Just like 7-7-2. Two would be too many. That would be a deal breaker for us. That's just too low. And I guess one thing I wanted to mention just as last, it's not in here, but I just want to bring it up, that there's still a problem. At one time we had tried to say patient registration cannot constitute cause for termination of employment. And that was turned down by our opponents. And there are still people, there are patients that are getting fired. I was recently an expert witness in December of a patient in Washington County, a flagger, who was fired because his jacket smelled like marijuana. He was brought before the supervisor. The supervisor said, you have to get a urine drug test. He says, there's no point in it. I've got a medical marijuana card. She said, if you don't turn in your medical marijuana card, we're going to fire you from Washington County. They did. We sued Washington County, and the judge threw the case out of court. So there are currently people losing their job who have not smoked marijuana for 9 to 10 hours before coming to work. And I really appreciate everything that you all are doing in the area of criminal liability, but there are issues like employment and housing that still exist. And I thank you very much for allowing me to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Morissette. My name is Leland Berger. I'm a lawyer. My bar number is 83020. I've been practicing for 21 years. I have a statewide practice defending medical marijuana patients and caregivers. I've practiced, I've represented patients from Ashland to Astoria and from Brookings to Baker City. I helped draft the Medical Marijuana Act, and I helped draft Measure 33, which was narrowly defeated at the polls last November. I greatly appreciate Dr. Baer's work, Madeline Martinez's work, and the work of the Oregon Medical Cannabis Alliance in bringing this bill before you, including, I should mention, Brian Michaels, who's a lawyer that's also doing the kind of work that I'm doing. Having said that, I'm sure you won't be surprised that, once again, our movement doesn't speak with a single voice, and we have a different opinion. I have different opinions from what Mr. Funk and Dr. Baer have mentioned. First of all, I understood, and help me if I'm wrong, that the intention of the -2 amendments is to abolish the mature-immature distinction that's presently in 475-306 and replace it with a mature, not a plant distinction. That was the way I read it, and if that's what you're doing, then I don't have a problem with mature being in there as a word. Regarding the starters, one of the things that's happening as a part of the medical cannabis laws in the 11 states where it's legal is that patients are finding that different strains are better for different conditions. A strain that would help with spasms would be different than a strain that would help with pain. A strain that would it might make you sleepy and be able to resolve insomnia issues, and another strain would be allow you to be alert. And the only way to develop those strains is to allow an unlimited number of clones or starters, and or a number that would approach that. And I would encourage you not to change that language. I disagree with what Dr. Baer said, and I had in my written testimony initially had suggested that it looked to me like, from my conversations with Craig Durbin from the state police and with Mark McDonald from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, that the only way to get a bill through the other chamber was to agree to repeal the affirmative defenses altogether, and that the only way to do that was to make sure that every patient, registered or not, would still be protected. And in my written testimony, I proposed how to do that. And I think that, and I greatly appreciate the effort that Senator Cruz and Senator Przanski and Representative March have taken to try and assuage those concerns by providing that under certain circumstances the affirmative defense is waived under the proposal and the amendments. Having said that, though, I'm confused a little bit by what you're doing, because it reads to me like in Section 9 that you're creating a third category of person. And actually, it looks like, and help me if I'm wrong, that you're directing, actually, Dr. Higginson to, in the Department of Human Services, to create a rule that would create this third kind of person who's not a patient and who's not a caregiver, but who's a person who grows marijuana for a registry identification card holder or the cardholder's designated primary caregiver, looking at page 9, lines 3 through 5. I'm not sure that that person would be protected from criminal liability simply by rule. And I think if you wanted to create a person like that, that you should include that person in ORS 475309, because when we drafted the Medical Marijuana Act initially, Section 1 casts a pretty broad net of protection, and I would assume that you would want this new category of person to have those protections from the criminal law as well. Another way I think you might be able to accomplish the same result is in 475302, currently sub 5, proposed sub 6, at page 2 of the -2 amendments, line 7. Every district attorney that I've encountered, and I mean elected officials and the deputies that are in charge of the drug units, including Mr. McConnell and Mr. Dingell, who are present from Marion and Multnomah counties, agree that a designated primary caregiver is a grower. The only entity that's ever taken the position that a designated primary caregiver meant something other than a person who was providing medical cannabis to a therapeutic cannabis to a medical cannabis patient was the Department of Human Services during the tenure of an acting director who took every opportunity to find a construction of the act that was contrary to patients, at least from my perspective. She's fortunately no longer the acting director. But what I'm trying to say is that you could amend designated primary caregiver to clarify that a person that significant responsibility for managing the well-being of a person who's been diagnosed with a debilitating medical condition and who's designated as such on that person's application for registry identification card or another written notification to the department means a person who's growing medical marijuana for the patient. And then you don't have to create this new category. It's a simpler way to accomplish the same thing you want to do. And I learned in 97 from Stormy Ray that patients have lots of different kinds of caregivers. They have caregivers, and I see Senator Cruz is nodding, so
yeah,
you know what I'm talking about. There's people that take care of your finances, yeah, people that... So we thought when we drafted the original Medical Marijuana Act in 98 that the designated primary caregiver, that the substantial or the significant responsibility for managing the well-being of the person was in cultivating and supplying the medical cannabis that they needed. So one way you could do that is accomplish that. I did have an opportunity to weigh it.
That just confused me.
Yeah, well, I guess to me primary caregiver in general means something completely different. I mean, if you're not, you know, so if you're going to define primary caregiver, you have to do it in relation to what you're talking about and not to be confused with someone else who is taking care of you as a primary caregiver. So, I mean, there are different categories, I would think.
The way we drafted the law was the protection of the act, mm-hmm, the exception to the criminal laws extended to patients and their caregivers, because their caregivers' conduct, the cultivation,
yeah, okay,
and delivery of marijuana would otherwise be illegal.
But the problem is, but in definition, in other statutes, primary caregiver, that's not what it is. Primary caregiver would be the person that takes care of, you know, whatever needs in the home, yeah, bathing, whatever it is. And so to call the grower a primary caregiver when it's probably off-site in most cases, it's a completely different definition for the same term. And we, what we may need to do, Mr. Chair, is come up with a different term.
Well, and I think that's doable simply by defining it in the statute that, you know, who we're talking about is the person who is the grower, whatever we call that person. And
right.
So we have to be sure that it's not to be confused with the primary caregiver.
And that's what I was, Chair Marcet and Senator Cruz, that's the, what I was trying to point out about the dash two amendments. You create a third category of person who's not defined in the definition section as
okay.
a grower.
I appreciate that because that's why we're having this hearing is to find out, you know, get some information about what we're missing from a different point of view.
And in terms of the limits, I have heard the 4-pound before, and a good place to go, Chris Conrad is an expert on cannabis production. I've utilized him in cases. He's in El Cerrito, California, but he has a website, chrisconrad.com, chrisconrad.com. I think he suggests 4 pounds. I when I was asked, I suggested 6 pounds because the federal government, under the Investigational New Drug Protocol,
yeah.
allows at least 6 pounds.
Yeah,
and so I think it gives us, in the same way I thought in measure 33, I think in 772 it would give some protection by saying, you know, this is the reason why we came to that. Similarly, when people are prosecuted in federal court for cultivation of marijuana, the in fact, for any drugs, it's converted, the weight is converted into plants, and then plants is defined by the sentencing guidelines as 1 pound per plant. So I think that there's some protection in defining it that way, notwithstanding the testimony from the Jackson County Sheriff that you heard last time about these giant plants that every patient in the room wished they could cultivate. You know, the reality is that the cases that I see involve, you know, bug-eaten indoor kinds of things, and you know, it doesn't take into account crop failure and other problems.
Are you saying that was a federal guidelines?
The federal sentencing guidelines
are 1 pound per plant. Is that what you're saying?
Chair Morris said, members of the committee, that is what I'm saying. I could be, you know, mistaken. The guidelines are in some flux now because of Supreme Court decisions that return discretion to federal judges, but that's where that number comes from, and so that would give it, I think, some credence.
Okay.
I guess the last thing is, I mean, I appreciate that there are lots of people with lots of interests, but, you know, my interest is in not standing next to any medical marijuana patient at sentencing ever again. I mean, that's how come I got involved in this work at a time when we weren't allowed to assert the defense. And the cases that I have now, principally, the issues that come up that aren't addressed by the Medical Marijuana Act that could be fixed involve release on recognizance, DUI diversion, probation and parole. And I had faxed to Senator Przanski, the Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision has come up with a policy under which people on post-prison supervision or parole can use cannabis therapeutically and be a medical marijuana patient. And I had also spoken with Judge Mark Gardner in Washington County about a possible rule for, you know, a demonstration that it's medically necessary to be able to use marijuana while you're on probation. But it's an ongoing problem. I mean, in Marion County, for example, patients have to choose between using medical marijuana. Patients who are being prosecuted have to choose between being able to use medical marijuana or going to prison in the plea offers that are being offered. So, I mean, that's the reality, and if it gets to judiciary, I'd be glad to talk to them about it.
Okay.
But again, I saw you in the hall when we were here on Senator Przanski's hemp bill, and I told you how much I appreciate it. I really, really, really appreciate your good work. Thank you, Chair Morris. Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Okay. Stephen Dingell. And Craig Durbin. And Joanne. I'm sorry, John McCann. I don't know how I got Joanne out of it.
Doesn't look like a Joanne.
No. Uh, Mr. Dingell.
Good afternoon, Chairman Morissette, members of the committee. My
now,
name is.
Let me just say that I patterned my this bill after your comments. It may not look like it now, but I I'm talking about the dash twos, and I went through that your letter, and I made a list of things that you recommended, and we tried to incorporate them. I don't know if they all got there, but anyway. Thank you.
Well, this puts me in a tough spot.
Yes. So I'll get your notes out here.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I have, like everyone else, just had an opportunity to barely or to quickly peruse.
Oh, would you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. I forgot that. Stephen Dingell from the Marion County District Attorney's Office here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I don't know how useful it is to try and list everything, but I would point out that there are a number of what I would consider to be pretty major things that law enforcement feels they need. If the statute's going to be changed to at least create the opportunity to find and prosecute those people who are abusing the statutes. Mm-hmm. The Dash 2 amendments don't have any requirement that the people carry the card and present it. There's nothing about inspections. I noticed that there's a requirement that the license be posted, but it doesn't say where it's going to be posted or whether or not. Because understand that under the current state of the law, Detective Durbin went up and said, I'd like to inspect your grow and see your license, they'd say, well, that's very well and good, but I don't even have to give you access to my house.
Yeah, but I think the point on carrying the card, and there is a lag time, which I think is unacceptable in terms of when you get the card, and that was one of the things that we somehow had to address. I mean, you need to have a card.
Well, and I think...
I know one of the things that you were concerned with is... You know, you stop someone and they have a piece of paper that says that, you know, and there's got to be a quicker turnaround time, I think.
Chairman Morissette, yes. And the other issue is that currently, under the state of the law, it's with medical marijuana cards, I have never understood this. It is completely different than driver's licenses, than concealed weapons permits. There is no requirement that if you have a card, that you carry it, nor is there any requirement that if you have a card and you're carrying it, that you present it to the officer. And so that sometimes puts officers in an awkward situation, because it is certainly not unheard of that people will not say anything, and then an officer is forced to make a decision. They take something away, and then the person shows up later with it. So that was really the issue that I was getting at. Okay. But I would just say that, in summary, given the quick review, I would say that the bill in its current form is probably not acceptable to the District Attorney's Association. However, I will send another letter and try to address the court's chair's concerns.
I was looking for your letter in here that I used and put points down that we talked about, and I guess I didn't encapsulate the idea of not only having the car, but having it on your person. Okay. What other cards must you have on your person if you don't drive?
Well, if you have a license, Chairman Morissette, I think the example I would give is the one that comes to mind is a concealed weapons permit.
Okay.
You know, the state licenses you to carry that weapon. You have to have that weapon. You have to have that card on your person. Fishing license, Mr. Durbin's pointed out, it's not enough if you're out fishing or hunting to say, I have a hunting and fishing license. I have my duck stamps. I have my upland bird stamp back at my house.
Okay, but I guess those are circumstances where you. Special circumstances where you need a card. Now, are you saying that you should have that card on your person at all times, or not?
Chairman, I'm not saying at all times. I'm saying that when you are, if you are a person under this act and you are out and about possessing a controlled substance,
absolutely.
Delivering it,
absolutely.
That when contacted by a law enforcement agent, you should be required to present this and say, I am a medical marijuana patient. Here is my card. I'm within the limit amounts. And I want to make sure that you understand, I'm also talking separately about these grows, because, again, we are very concerned that these grows are subject to being abused by certain people. And so the only way that law enforcement feels comfortable, or at least prosecutors do, is having the ability to inspect and make certain that we don't have people who are growing more than they're supposed to and delivering it to people they're not supposed to. And so that's a separate issue apart from just the person who's out and about. Again, having requiring someone to post a license at a grow indicating how many people they're growing for and whom is really an empty protection if there's no way for law enforcement to inspect and verify that.
Okay. Now, how do you inspect and verify under the existing law?
We don't.
Okay.
We don't. It's strictly voluntary with the person who does it. For example, I know that I briefly talked with law enforcement, and I know the district attorneys would support this. If law enforcement was given 24-hour, 7-day-a-week access to LEDs, the people who have these cards, the people who are the growers, the caregivers, with their addresses, I personally would support a requirement that would say that any search warrant obtained by law enforcement for marijuana that did not run the address and the names through that system would be invalid on its face. Law enforcement doesn't want to go out and get a search warrant and go through all that trouble to find that the person actually has. That's a lot of wasted effort on their part. But again, currently there's no way to do that.
Now, would you routinely randomly check, or would it be probable cause, or...
I think, Chairman, my position would be that they could do it whenever they wanted, but I think practically speaking, given the numbers that are out there, the only time you're going to see law enforcement doing that is when they have a concern about a specific person. I discussed this with Mr. Durbin. There's not personnel to go out and inspect every single row.
Isn't that a probable cause issue then? You suspect you get a search warrant and go out and do that.
But there, I can see situations of less than probable cause where someone who wants to remain anonymous or whatever. And I can tell you right now, we have received in our office anonymous complaints from individuals who are afraid, who say that people under the guise of the LMMA are growing and selling marijuana or not giving us our medicine. But I am fearful for, I will not identify myself, I will not be even a confidential, reliable informant in an affidavit because I believe there'll be backlash from that part of the community. And that is going to be the place where, quite honestly, that is going to be the truest source of abuses are people who are legitimate patients who see abuses in the program but are fearful of a backlash if they step forward and say, this person's breaking the law or sneaking around the OMMA.
Okay.
And I would be happy to send another letter, Chairman.
Craig? Thank you.
Chair Morris, members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin, lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and commander of the Drug Enforcement Section, and I'm speaking on behalf also of Oregon Chiefs of Police and Oregon Sheriff's Association. They have read the amendment. They were not able to be here today. But basically on face, we would be in opposition to it. However, we do appreciate the work that's been done by the committee, and we also, in fact, I participated in that letter, so when you said that, so... But there are issues that, looking at it, that we feel are not addressed that really do need to be addressed, and some very major issues that do concern us. And I think I've spoke with Mr. Berger and also with Stormy Ray about these issues, and in a lot of respects, we can be in consensus on a number of these issues. And I think we both agree, and several others in the patient caregiver area, agree that some of these areas need to be cleaned up, and they need to be cleaned up not only for law enforcement, but they need to be cleaned up for the patients themselves. Yeah. Because, again, we, just as Mr. Dingell was speaking, that we do not want to be in a position where we're taking action against individuals that have a legitimate use of their medicine, and then we take action against them, and then we as law enforcement end up in some kind of a tort claim or something like that, or we take their medicine away from them. So there's some areas, in particular, in the real concerns, and then in this other category of persons, who could be a grower. We already still have the concerns with the caregiver that we do not feel are being addressed in here, such as there's no background checks on them at all. If they're in the program and they violate the program, that there's no real revocation other than a 6-month revocation of their license or their card. And now you have another category of persons that is not a caregiver, they're not a patient, but there's no checks whatsoever. There's no ability for the program itself to police these people if in fact they are found to be manufacturing or distributing. Basically, they can if this holds, they could pull their license for 6 months and that's all they could do, and they'd be back in the program growing again. As Mr. Dingell was speaking also about that, the issue within the program itself, that's true. We do get calls from patients within the program that have said, I know this person is in excess amounts. What can we do at that point? Well, if we, basically it is a probable cause situation, but if we have nobody that goes in there and wants to identify themselves, we have nobody that's witness to, the only thing we could do is call up the program. They said, yes, in fact, that person is a grower. And we could go knock on the door and ask them to voluntarily show us that grow. But if they say no, there's nothing we can do. And there is no mechanism within the program itself, even by DHS, to be able to go out and inspect that site. And that's one of the things, I think, if there was anything else in this program that would really clean up this program, was to require the program itself to have inspectors that would go out and inspect the program. Board of Pharmacy has that for controlled substances, but this program has none.
Okay, I will call up Grant Higginson, Dr. Higginson, who is back there in a few minutes, because I'm interested in the inspection. Now, that's a fiscal impact, but then on the other hand, I understand there is a money in a reserve fund that has been growing and so on and so forth. I don't know what the status of that is, but regular inspectors other than law enforcement might be much less onerous in many ways, but they would be representing the department and they would have the authority to do whatever has to be done, but it would be a little different than having a sheriff's car pull up in front of your house and people coming in. That kind of arouses the neighborhood, and you know, I can understand why patients are nervous about having that happen, but I think that's an interesting idea, and it may have been said before, but I haven't heard it, so I think that's something that we should consider, because if that's one of your biggest concerns, that may be something that could be solved.
Chair Morris, we did, I believe, put that in the letter, but again, in sake of time, we'll go ahead and submit.
I do appreciate it if you could do that again, and we will distribute the letter to our committee, but we are trying to collect varying points of view and trying to mesh them together, and so it's very important that we get your concerns and we get them in writing so we can remember them and work on them. So continue, please.
Chairman Morris, members of the committee, I'll just say it would be okay with the committee. We'll go ahead and meet with the Sheriffs and Chiefs Association, the district attorneys, and put our recommendations down on paper and forward our concerns for this. But in closing, I do believe that we can work through this, and that we're willing, and we have spoke with members of the group behind me.
Yeah.
We're willing to concede on some of these issues if we can also have some very clear, bright lines. That's our main concern, and one of those the bright lines that we really need is the affirmative defense issue, and we'll put those down on paper and forward them to the committee.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Chairman Morissette, the committee, I want to thank you for this opportunity. My name is John McCamus, not Joanne, but John, and I'm with Roseburg Forest Products. We're a large employer in Douglas County. We employ about 3,500 people down there, and I'm here to represent the employer's perspective with recent case law that was passed, Columbia Forest Products in Washburn. Most of our jobs are heavy manufacturing, heavy industrial, and we're concerned from a safety perspective, the lack of guidance the law provides for folks with medical marijuana cards. Level of impairment, lack of specificity around that. Simple guidelines like that would help us as an employer work with folks that may be issued a medical marijuana card. We have a agreed upon policy, substance abuse policy with our union, WCIW, as do many large wood products employers around the state. And lack of clarity from those kinds of things put us in a real difficult position. And so expanding this law without giving some, taking this opportunity to put in there some guidance for employers on how we can best work within those guidelines, we would be opposed to that now, so you take this opportunity to give us some guidance.
There is a group working on an amendment to deal with that.
Very and good.
That's been brought to our attention that there needs to be some guidelines. The clarification is what
Very
we're
good.
Looking for.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir.
Okay, Aaron. Aaron Hildebrand, Walter Hagen, Jerry Wade, and then Jerry, you want to wait until Stormy comes up?
Yeah.
Okay. Todd. Dalaretto. Are you there? No. You wait until yeah. Okay. Now we're running out of time. So if you can now again, what I'm trying to emphasize are concentrating on the things that we're trying to improve. So good, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Morissette and committee. Yes, my name is Todd Dalaretto. I have over 6 years' experience working hands-on with patients. I'm a patient myself, and I have been a caregiver. Mm-hmm. Direct support to patients through Compassion Center in Eugene, as well as my own private consultation education practice. And I was also on the legislative advisory committee that was convened the other year. Having so much experience with patients and their difficult situations trying to obtain a reliable supply of medicine, mm-hmm. OMA as currently written, obviously a lot of patients are having a difficult time. Part of that is because a lot of patients are beginner growers, and that's particularly where the plant and possession limits come into play. With them, particularly indoor growers may have severe spider mite problems. Is one of the biggest problems with patients, getting enough off their harvest. And we have a lot of fill in the blanks around the plant limits and possession limits around the annual and year round growing. Mm-hmm. I do support a 28 plant limit for annual gardeners, as long as we remove the. I also support removing mature, as Stormy had suggested earlier in this process. So that it's just basically, 28 plants for
annual
growth.
Oh, we really
haven't
heard Stormy yet.
Well, I'm sorry, earlier in past months. In the interim legislative committee, she made a proposal around removing the word mature.
Oh, good.
Don't want to speak for her either. And for year-round gardeners, I think, seven plants at a time, removing mature, would be sufficient. Around possession limits, I support removing the certain amount of ounces per plant. I think that is not very important. I think having a standard possession limit. For annual growers, I suggest support at least 64 ounces per patient. And I only got to read the recent amendments just before the session started, so I hesitate to comment on too many details around that. I will be submitting more comments in writing, but I did notice that the possession limits at the end of the harvest cycle for annual growers. Mm-hmm. That's problematic because they would only be allowed to possess that when it's harvested and not for the rest of the year. So it's probably just a little wording glitch. So I recommend that at any given time or some sort of wording to indicate that the patient is allowed to possess medicine other than, the time than just after harvest.
Wait a minute. The idea of an annual grow, mm-hmm. 28 plants or whatever, you deliver either 4 pounds or 5 pounds to that patient. Now, that's mm-hmm. supposed to last that patient the entire year,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Yes.
Okay. So we know when the annual grow is over. Mm-hmm. That's documented.
Mm-hmm.
We know when it starts. We know when it's over. So you would assume that the patient would have a diminishing amount and that would run out just in time to start a new one. Now, mm-hmm. There are problems. I don't know what happens if you run out too soon. I don't know what happens if you have stuff left over. But I don't know what you were saying.
I would just suggest wording to guarantee that over the course of the year that the patient is able to possess as much medicine as that patient needs to mitigate their medical conditions.
Now, that implies then, which is a very important point, that there must be then a source available if they need it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we haven't considered that.
Right. Oregon Medical Marijuana Act does provide for the sharing of medicine as long as it's not for consideration and as long as it's within legal limits.
Okay, now, Stormy did mention that mm-hmm. also, but I don't know if that complicates what we're trying to do or not. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. But I think it's important that there be adequate supply,
mm-hmm.
and if we set arbitrary limits of what you get at the beginning of the year, then mm-hmm. there could be, obviously, that's what we're wrestling with. Is how
right. Yeah, a couple, yeah, and there are, you know, with varying patients with varying medical conditions, mm-hmm. you know, there's a huge variety of amounts that patients need for their medical condition, just the same as cultivation techniques. Outdoor gardens can be harvested as early as September and as late as December. They don't all just, you know, ripen in at the same time.
Okay.
So putting a pinpoint on at the time of harvest for an outdoor grow would be very difficult.
No, I don't think that is what we intend. What we would do is say when it starts. You're going to start.
Begin at the same time, correct.
At a particular date, and then that's what we had talked about is mm-hmm. the starting time, because the ending time is hard, but there would not be another planting. It would just be one grow.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah. And with regards to seedlings, that's an area where the beginner grower, which, you know, in my experience, there's always beginner growers. There's always new patients into the program. Whether you've had experience at growing vegetables and roses in your life, even very experienced gardeners growing marijuana for the first time can have a very difficult time. And with seedlings and clones, beginner growers often, 50% of them die, you know, right off the bat. More experienced growers have a better survival rate. So we need to keep this into consideration when we're discussing the number of seedlings someone is allowed to have. As Rick suggested, as Rick suggested putting the number at 14, I don't think that'll work because it's hard to cultivate 28 plants out of 14 seedlings. But I guess we have to come up with some sort of limit, to make it digestible for, for the full house or I'd suggest somewhere around 100, because if you were attempting to cultivate 28 plants, to end up with 28 plants that you harvest,
okay.
and you start out with 100, and up to 50% die. If they're seedlings, up to 50% will be male, and you're going to get rid of those as well.
Now, it just seems to me that if you're doing a annual grow at a site mm-hmm. that is posted, that it would be easier to have some flexibility in terms, because it's a one-time grow and a one-time, in a site. And so mm-hmm. if the inspector, so to speak, were to come by and take a look, then it would be easier to understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
That you have more seedlings with the idea. So I think having an annual grow, which law enforcement wants in terms of control, mm-hmm. would be lend itself to what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to give more flexibility as an annual grow because it's contained.
Correct.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So basically, I've found if you want to end up with 28 good plants that you're going to grow to maturity and harvest. You would need at least 100 seedlings to start off with, taking into account mortality, taking into account that half of them may likely be males, which, you know, don't provide good medicine, and that you would want to pick the best out of what you have left. And also, we need to take into consideration sharing. It's nice to produce an abundance that we are able to share for no consideration with other patients who are not as fortunate enough to have an abundant supply. And also breeding. As Lee Berger pointed out earlier, there are thousands of strains out there with varying medical efficacy. And breeding is very important to not only finding having a supply of the right strains for the right conditions, but also the right growing conditions as well. And breeders need a lot of plants to be able to successfully, you know, breed. I won't go into detail about all the complexities around that. But that would be a reason for having, you know, more seedlings.
We kind of wrap it up because we have a few more.
Sure. I'm going to be looking over these amendments in much greater detail and putting good thought and returning some comments to you about them.
Thank you. And I would appreciate any of you who have testified or who will testify to do the same, or anyone in the room who want to give written testimony and comments, because that will help a lot.
Okay.
Go ahead.
My name is Erin Hildebrandt, and I live in Lafayette with my family.
Okay.
I just have a few points that I wanted to make today. First, thank you very much for taking the time to listen to us. I'm not terribly concerned about the number of plants. Quite honestly, most of this really wouldn't concern me a whole lot. I think that the numbers are fine for me personally. I wouldn't trade away the affirmative defense, so that really doesn't affect me personally. But I've been talking to an awful lot of patients, and especially if what you're saying, if I'm understanding this correctly, is anyone who has an outdoor grow would automatically lose their affirmative defense. And there's an awful lot of people that just can't afford the electric bills to grow indoors, and these people shouldn't lose their affirmative defense just because they're less well off than others.
Now, wait a minute. I guess I have to understand this. If you have an outdoor grow, outdoors, so why is the affirmative defense important for an annual grow, just once a year? I'm sorry. Yeah, an annual grow.
Well, my understanding is that the affirmative defense gives people the right, if they're prosecuted, to tell the judge why they possessed or grew marijuana. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, but what we're trying to think of, what we're looking at in the affirmative defense is that there would be notification, you're going to do the grow, there would be posting. Now, we put posting in here, but Craig Derman or someone said that there was an adequate posting, but obviously, if you're going to do it for an annual grow, someone's going to visit you. Probably someone will come, law enforcement or DAS or whoever is an inspector, and check it out. It's a one-time grow. How many seedlings you're going to have, I don't know if that's an issue. Maybe that has to be addressed.
Do all of the outdoor growers then automatically lose the right to the affirmative defense if this goes through the way it's
done? Not only the one-time annual grow, the big grow would lose affirmative.
So if they wanted to keep the smaller limits and
they
could still grow outdoors, that's not being changed.
No.
Okay, that's what I was trying to figure
out. Now, that's the law enforcement hates affirmative defense, and what we're trying to do is craft an annual grow which would not have affirmative defense, which would be fairly defined. You know, you could grow up to for four individuals, say, and that would be, there would be a beginning time that you would have to post. The names of the people that you're growing for would have to be designated, where the grow is, and so on. And then when it's over, that's it, no more.
Okay, but you're not precluding anyone from growing outdoors and not doing the increased limits with the one big annual crop?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, that's what I wanted to find out. I'm opposed to anything that would remove anyone's right to an affirmative defense. If someone else wants to opt out, like I think I used the comparison before with the Miranda laws, if someone else wants to waive their rights, that's up to them, and I'm not going to argue, yeah. But I don't want anyone else's rights just taken away without them having a choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. I was also concerned about in section 8 number 1E, if this could be clarified a little bit, any other information the department considers necessary, where they're talking about what you have to submit in an application to the department, is that something that is specified somewhere else, or is that just, you know, if the administrator that day wants to ask people, okay, what's your favorite color? Is it anything that they imagine they can ask, or?
Well, I this,
actually, Ms. Chair, when you're building administrative rules around a program, you can't be point specific in all cases in the ORSs, and you have to give some flexibility if things change or if things need to be modified without having to go back and change statutes. So that gives the department the flexibility. Is really all it does. It's not saying you can do whatever you want.
Okay.
It's going to be reason and within reason, but they do need a certain amount of flexibility.
Okay.
Yeah,
and okay.
They go through public vetting. Oh yeah, they go through administrative rules or public hearings and all that. So, but we
okay.
You can't on virtually anything we do in this building. You can't be so specific in law that you make it entrenched. You've got to give an agency some room to modify as conditions modify, or federal law, or whatever we're talking
okay.
about. So this is kind of a standard thing that we would do.
Okay. And you're with the when you're talking about inspections, then you're talking about something that's outdoors where somebody chooses to grow a whole lot of plants. You're not talking about, like, the police can come knock on my door and say, we want to look inside your closet garden. Because to me, that would be terrorizing my 5-year-old kids. And unless you do that to diabetics to inspect their needles and make sure those aren't going to the black market, I would be offended.
I guess the idea of the annual grow and getting rid of the affirmative defense is a kind of a compromise thing where affirmative defense would not be necessary in an annual grow. Now, after the annual grow, all of the marijuana grown will be delivered to each patient, and there will be no marijuana grown on that site. So it's a beginning, it's an end. The end is indeterminate depending upon the plants, but once it's over, it's over. The supplier will put it in his car. Now, do you need an affirmative defense to carry 4 or 5 pounds of marijuana from your supply shop to? I guess there has to be some kind of a card. Do the suppliers have cards?
The caregivers?
Yeah, caregivers.
My husband is my caregiver, and he has a card.
Okay, I'm sorry.
His name.
Do the caregivers who grow on a separate site, do the patients pick it up, or do they deliver?
Either one.
Okay, I would say then, if the caregiver or grower or supplier is delivering, they have to have some identification. Do they have that now? They do. Okay, good. So I don't, you know, so there shouldn't be a need for a deferment of offense on that kind of a grow. It should be, now I don't know how many people would choose to do that. I mean, we're not mandating annual grows, but that's an option. And if you choose to do the one-time grow, then. And some people might prefer that, and some growers might prefer that.
So that could even be indoors. If you could choose an annual grow, it doesn't matter if you're growing outdoors or indoors.
No, it doesn't matter.
It's timing and the amount. Is that it?
Yeah, it doesn't specify it has to be outdoors. And I could imagine that I would love to see a central grow site or several central grow sites around where, you know, it could be grown safely, and then people could go to that grow site and get what they need. I mean, that to me is the simplest thing. It solves all kinds of problems, and so we're, you know, a central grow site might work very well. It might catch on.
And that wouldn't take away of our rights to grow it in our backyard.
Okay, well, I have to be careful. An annual grow site might lead into a larger solution. I mean, maybe that might demonstrate that that's the best way to handle this, and then that would eliminate their affirmative defense because everyone would be packaged, and you know, it would be,
you mean we wouldn't
lines
be able
would
to
be drawn,
and we couldn't grow it at home anymore in that case.
Well, you can't do both, I don't think.
Okay.
I mean, you could do one or the other. I mean, you can opt to do what you as you're doing.
Okay. I see.
We're not going to change. Okay, the one thing that nobody's mentioned, I guess we did, it cuts down the number of patients that a grower can grow for from
unlimited
to two, which, you know, I expected all kinds of hollering, screaming, shouting right there. Okay. Okay, we can talk about that. I mean, I don't know. I guess we had that discussion. Yeah. What we're trying to do is not make it more difficult for patients. We're trying to accommodate patients in a way that will not cause unnecessary legal problems is what we're trying to do. Okay, we're running over time, and Stormy hasn't even started yet. Oh yeah, there are a few others. Okay, thank you very much. Sandy Burbank? No. Burkle. Burbank. Okay. And Cliff Spencer. And Alice. Alice. Okay. And then we will go to... Okay, we have Walter Hagen, Jerry Wade, and Stormy. Now, we're going to try to get out of here by 5:30 if possible. That's a great tie you have on, sir.
Thank you.
I'm Sandy Burbank. I'm with Mothers Against Misuse and Abuse, and you all received a packet from us last Monday. Mm-hmm. I hope you got some of our birthday cake
as
we were celebrating.
Yes, thank you.
I am a patient. Mm-hmm. I am a caregiver. I was one of the people who sat on the interim advisory committee. I meet regularly, quarterly now, with the administrative work group, with the head of the program and the head, Dr. Higginson. And I want to thank you very, very much for all the work you've done to try to understand this very complex issue that we can't even all agree on ourselves, and we understand it more than you. One thing I want to bring, I'm going to just go really fast. In the listing of the debilitating medical conditions, there has been a decision, I believe, a while back, and Dr. Higginson could probably clear this up, that agitation from Alzheimer's has been included quite some time back, and a lot of people, if they look at this law the way it's written, might not realize that, and I would really like to see that added.
Okay, I thought I saw that, but maybe not. Okay, I'll make note.
Okay. I just want to tell you this. I'm a caregiver for 10 patients. I grow outside. I grow most of the crop for those people outside, and at the end of the harvest, I give them everything that I can legally give them, and then anything else that I have, I give away, and that's growing within the legal limits of the law right now. So there's going to be a lot of disparity between what one person can grow outside and what another person can grow. I'm worried when patients who are growing outside can't replant for whatever reason, because you can have people steal your plants.
No, wait a minute.
Well, I'm talking about the 28 plants, the big outdoor, well, the annual.
I see, okay.
What's that called?
The annual garden. Yeah.
Not the annual. No.
Yeah, it's the annual garden.
Annual garden.
Okay, but I want to be sure I got the right.
Well, that's...
Year-round, okay, annual, that's what I'm talking about, right? Because there are reasons, legitimate reasons, why people may need to replant. Ourselves, we've had plants stolen, called the police, and they came at our request. another thing I'm concerned about on page 2 of this, the bigger ones,
okay.
It says delivery has the meaning given that does not include transfer of marijuana by a registry identification cardholder to another registry identification cardholder if no consideration is paid for the transfer. What I want to be sure is that it does not change our ability to give away cannabis, our excess, to other patients who are legally registered who are not our patients. Is that correct?
I don't think we addressed that. Is that you can do that currently?
We can currently, and I'll tell you that that covers so many people, and the people that hospice sends me, the people that the law enforcement people send me, our sheriff's office send me, and that doctors send me, are all patients that are not my patients, but we freely give to them, and I would like to be sure that's addressed.
We did not address that.
Well, it is in this in these amendments here, so I want to be sure. Another thing is law enforcement doesn't like the law that makes marijuana illegal for some and legal for others for obvious reasons. And trying to appease them is going to, I don't think it's ever going to work. If we just legalized marijuana across the board, it would make their clear, bright line a lot easier. But since we're not doing that, I don't think we're ever going to be able to set a plant limit or an amount limit that will ever meet everything. And I think the best thing is if law enforcement proves a crime, that there are sales going on, then that would be over what the patient needed. It's the kind of proof that they have to have when they prove other kinds of crimes. I don't think that this is any more of a burden than any other crime. They get their information, and they should go for it. One of the things that happens with us growing outside like this, we do, and we end at the year, is that we have strains that we want to protect because we know they're good. We may not have seeds. So then we need to rely on indoor growers so that they can keep those strains alive for us through the winter time, and that requires a cooperation that's not really addressed in any of this. Also,
Wait. How do you protect the strain by taking a clipping?
What I did this last year is I gave parent plants, or a cutting, they were really small at the time, to somebody who had an indoor garden, and then we had to depend that they wouldn't kill it, so that's kind of scary. And then they use it for their garden, and then in the spring we can get cuttings back from that. But it really does require cooperation between indoor growers and outdoor growers. Did I make myself clear?
Yes.
Okay. We need more caregivers now. I'm constantly besieged by people who are sent to me by totally reputable people, doctors, I mentioned law enforcement, hospice, that are looking for people who need caregivers. As a person who runs a clinic for patients, we have patients immediately wanting medicine. And, of course, it's impossible. There's so many issues here. A lot of patients, like Albie Musica, who is one of the six federal legal, or one of the federal legal patients, gets 6 pounds per year. She has glaucoma. So one of the first things she does when she gets her tin of medicine is she takes part of that medicine out and she cooks things with it because she has to keep it in her system 24 hours a day at night when she sleeps. So that's where that 6 pounds cannot seem as much as it is. And for certain conditions, people who have epilepsy, glaucoma, those things where you have to have it in your system all the time, that 6 pounds isn't too outrageous. But I think that 4 pounds on the average would probably protect most patients. But again, there's never going to be a perfect amount.
Now, this is not a prescription drug, obviously. Do doctors differentiate when they write letters? They do not differentiate. So if a person has glaucoma or the condition that would require that they keep it in their systems all the time.
No, they do not write anything like that. However, one of the things that we do at our clinic is we're teaching doctors about dosages, cannabis therapeutics, and also problems that people might have using medical marijuana with other drugs that they're taking. We have a real need. We would like to see the health department supply this information, but right now that burden is falling on the patients to educate doctors and patients.
Okay. How much money is in your reserve fund, to your knowledge?
Well, actually, I can answer that question because because we probably don't have a whole lot now. It's going to work down over the next couple of years, because when we reduced our first fees, we had $500,000. When we reduced our fees the second time, we had $1 million. As a patient and as an advocate, I would advocate that we retain some of that money in the program to provide education about possibilities of drug interactions and dosage and all that. Now, right now, it's just out there, and the doctors, some of them don't know the answers.
Okay, is there a statutory limit on the reserve, or is that just an administrative rule, or
no,
what?
No, it's not.
It's supposed
limit.
To.
So who makes a decision on lowering the fees or giving it back and so on?
We basically covered that in the Administrative Advisory Committee.
Okay.
And then there's the public hearings and...
Okay, so theoretically the Administrative Advisory Committee could do a number of things to improve patient service and improve inspections. I mean, rather than have law enforcement drive up in front of your house with a, you know, I mean...
Right. And one of the things I would advocate for immediately is the 24/7 verification that we heard some of the law enforcement speak to.
Yeah.
That's absolutely important. We need to have that. It should have been in place already. We've been advocating as patients that we would be willing to pay for it ourselves. Take it out of those funds. We think it's that important. Another thing would be, and we've been trying to get this taken care of for several years now, is an unscrupulous patient, the way the law is written right now, I could name this person as my, and I would like to suggest that instead of calling these people primary caregivers, we call them OMMP caregivers, which would make it all so much more clear. OMMP caregivers, that makes it real easy. But I could obtain her as my caregiver, she could be producing medicine for me. Unbeknownst to her, I could fill out a change form right now that would allow me to name Clifford. And unless I choose to tell her, she will not know she's a Class A felon. And then I could hire this get this person right here to do it, and I'd have two Class A felons that would not have any notification, because that all falls on the patient right now. We've been trying to get the program to pay for this with the notice that goes out right away with the new one, and
okay.
We still want to see that
okay.
happen.
Now,
and they say the only way they can do that is legislatively.
Okay.
Okay. So.
No, wait, please.
I'm sorry.
I want you to put some of these things in writing so we will have them. They're good ideas. They're benefiting both patients and law enforcement and so on. So these are the kinds of things we're looking for. We can't solve all of the problems in 1 year, though, but we do want to move something that is better than we have now.
I just have a couple of more.
A couple more, okay.
All right, the other one is on the amendments number 2 on the first page, in the page 1. It talks about anybody with a multiple person grow site does not have an affirmative defense. That's what it says right here. That is deleted? Oh, okay, thank you. All right. And the last thing. Okay, and I already addressed the must plant at one time. I'm very concerned about that because there are a lot of different issues. And I will submit everything to Reddit. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to call Dr. Higginson up for just a moment, so then he can leave. But I want to get a response, or at least I have some questions, and perhaps Senator Truesdale. You're going to miss the traffic. What the heck? Okay, I guess my questions revolve around the fund. Now, what connection do you... Is the fund under the auspices of your department, the reserve fund, the fees that are paid, and so on?
Yeah, Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson with the Department of Human Services.
Okay.
All the fees that are collected go into a fund pool that is specifically earmarked for the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program.
Okay.
When we first started this program, you know, we were dealing with totally unknown issue, how many patients there were going to be, how many cards were going to be registered, how much it would actually cost. And so at the time, we set a fee of $150 per patient based on figuring we were going to have about 500 patients with the first couple of years per year for the first couple of years. Over the next 2-3 years, it became evident with the growth of the program that there were excessive cash balances, and so we dropped the fee to different tiers depending on whether or not it was a renewal and depending on whether or not a person could show that they were low income. Still, even with that, the cash balances continued to grow until, as someone said, we had nearly $1 million in cash balances recently. In working with the advisory group that we work with on a quarterly basis, we came up with a new schedule where the fees have been substantially reduced so that they are now $50, except for those people that can show financial hardship, in which case it's $20. With those kind of fees, our fiscal folks are saying that they believe that by the end of the biennium, what we will have is a cash balance that is 3 to 6 months operating funds for the program, which is what we've been told by DAS, Department of Administrative Services, that we should have in a program like that.
Now, serving for the first time on a Ways and Means Subcommittee, I know that all fee-based agencies come to the subcommittee or to Ways and Means concerning fees, raising fees, cash balance, all of that stuff. And I guess my question is, do you consider improvements to the program as part of a legitimate expenditure? Now, who may decide that? I would imagine it would be up to maybe the advisory council to make some suggestions. And are those suggestions then acted upon or considered and implemented?
Chair Morissette, that's correct. We have this advisory work group to provide suggestions to the program. It is the program that makes the final administrative decisions. Most of the time, I believe that, all the time we take the input seriously. Most of the time we act on those recommendations. There have been some occasions where we do not see eye to eye with the advocates and have not acted on those.
Okay. How about the turnaround time in an application and the issuance of a card?
Right now, and we have an audit that we've been working on, the audit outstanding issues now for a couple of years, and the last time that we looked at the issue of card completion, we had 100% completion from the time a application was complete and getting that out within 30 days.
Very good.
Okay, there's some disagreement, however, on what the 30 days means, because there are some people who believe that this 30 days should start when we receive the application, regardless of whether or not it's complete. And we will try. We are in the process of trying now to streamline things as much as possible to get it so that it's 30 days for everyone. But I don't think the program should be held responsible for applications that aren't complete and either aren't getting completed because of patient negligence or doctor not giving us the information.
Okay. I think that's a good point. And I know we're dealing with another agency with repayments to local safety net clinics that has exactly that problem, because the complaint was it takes 7 months, and the answer was, well, if you do it right the first time, it wouldn't take that long. We have a 30-day turnaround. That's an interesting point, and I think, that's something that has to be worked on, that people have to get a completed form. Okay, I guess I don't know. Those were my questions, and there is flexibility in the fund, and there are some things that have been suggested that might improve the process with some additional investment. And then you go to Ways and Means and talk about this as an issue for your department, for the public health department? It's under your jurisdiction. Is this
Yes, Chair Morissette, this will be considered, you know, in the regular budget hearings when we get to that phase in the Ways and Means process. Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on what we were saying and a comment that I believe Sandy Burbank made was that, you know, there's this 24/7 verification system, which we totally agree is something that has to be done, and whether it passes on in legislation or not, we're committing to getting that done. And the development of that system for verification will come out of the fees that have been collected.
Okay, so that's something you plan to do. I mean, you don't need legislation, or would legislation be helpful?
Chair Morissette, we don't need to have legislation. I believe it would be helpful. I believe it would be helpful to keep our feet to the fire and state police's feet to the fire to get this done. And I also think it's a good idea to have it in statute that's an expectation.
Good. I think so.
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Grant. I mean, if we're talking about other than law enforcement doing inspection, that certainly falls on you, and that would be an expense probably not factored in when you redid your fees. So, and also if we're talking about an education component, that's another thing that should factor in. So, I mean, if we're going to address things like that, that has impact on your budget and your fee schedule. So, at least a kind of a ballpark read on what, on an estimate of that before we get into phase three might be helpful.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, that I really would need some time to think through to get back an actual even ballpark budget figure. When I was hearing the discussion about the department and the medical marijuana program actually doing the inspections, some red flags went up for me. Number one is right now, looking at the Act, I do not believe that we have the authority to do that. I mean, it's not addressed in the Act. I'm not sure we even have the authority to do that.
The point I'm making is, before we were to give you that authority, we would need to make sure that the resources would be available to comply.
Right. And Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, if I could follow up, I also think that one thing we'd really have to think about are safety issues. I mean, I would be very uncomfortable taking people who are untrained and putting them in a position where they're going into a situation where it could become a very contentious issue. I also don't know what the expectations would be if we found something. Our DHS inspectors that we thought to be criminal activity, is that then the responsibility of those people to actually try to deal with it at that time? And again, I don't think that we have the authority to do that, and I'm not sure we have the skills to do it either. And one thing I would really like to look at, I mean, a couple of other options would be to have us be the people who are coming up with a schedule of when places get investigated, but still leaving it to law enforcement to do the investigation. And the other thing I'd like to think about is what is the OLCC model. What do they do in the way of inspections and sting operations and things to make sure that people with liquor licenses are adhering to their license? I mean, I think that's a model that would be worth exploring if the committee decides to move forward with this.
Well,
idea.
I don't think that's something we're going to do in this bill. I mean, that's there are things that we will probably follow up on, perhaps, but one of the things is cost. Is it cost effective to have the state police or law enforcement devoting their time to doing this when there are other things they could be doing? If we went this route, it would, I think, and with the understanding that people would be adequately retrained, the duties would be, you know, very exacting. And, you know, I mean, it might be a more cost-effective way, and it could be, I think you mentioned the OLCC model where those people, they have the discretion to do a lot. They don't have the gun and the badge, but they certainly can enforce. I think it's worth it. And I would expect someone like that to come through your group for at least vetting, I mean, to talk about it and talk about law enforcement.
And Chair Morissette, that is one thing, actually, in the interim legislative work group that we had that we did talk about, and a lot of what I've heard today is this whole idea of there's very differing viewpoints here between law enforcement and advocates.
I think you're getting closer together.
Well, I think so too, and one of the issues was if you're going to provide more flexibility with grow sites, what is it on the law enforcement side that you can provide in the way of regulation or at least understanding that there is more control over the program? And the idea of registering and having inspections was one thing that was discussed, but it didn't move forward in the straw man legislation that we provided to you.
Good. Have any questions? Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome.
We can go home now.
Yeah. and you know, the traffic is, you know. Okay. Yes. Would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Yes. Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz. My name is Clifford Spencer. I'm a medical marijuana patient. I was one of the first patients on the program. I have four cervical herniated discs and a double laminectomy. More importantly, I'm here because of my volunteer work and unique perspective. As a volunteer, incurring the associated expenses myself along with a group of several other people, we assist patients who are in residential care with implementation of Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act. Patients in residential care are those who are too physically challenged or ill to live on their own. It includes a hospice, residential care facility, for example, for people living with advanced AIDS, people dying of cancer, quadriplegics, people like Christopher Reed, paralyzed from the neck down. And so these are very unique type of patient. Certainly the type of patients for whom OMA was mostly written, the neediest of the needy, and quite frankly the poorest of the poor. Many of the patients I work with, all of their income from Social Security except for $30 a month goes to the residential care facility. So these people aren't really in a position where they can go buy medical marijuana out on the black market, nor are they even in a position to reimburse caregivers for production-related expenses. Matter of fact, it's really difficult for them to come up with their $20 application fee. So as a result, what we are able to do is recruit caregivers who, at the caregiver's own expense, produce this medicine for these patients. It's not an easy task to find caregivers willing to do a whole heck of a lot of work, and it is a lot of work, to undertake this responsibility and expense at their own expense. As a result, I continuously struggle to produce enough medicine for these people. I work with 8 facilities. It's a full-time job in and of itself in coordinating this effort, but I also work another full-time job to pay my light bill, to pay the gas to put in my truck to get to see these patients. It's a real challenge to find people who are willing to do this, to be caregivers, at their own expense. A heck of a lot of work and responsibility that they don't get reimbursed for. And now I'm hearing proposed legislation to, in addition to these people having to pay their light bill and do all this work for nothing, to give up their constitutional rights for unreasonable search, for warrantless searches, their right to privacy, any affirmative defense they might have. And I think it would then make it impossible for me to recruit people to do this. And furthermore, I would not be willing to give up my constitutional rights to try and help the sickest of the sick and dying. I've had 19 people die since I started doing this volunteer work. And so I get to see, in working with these patients, firsthand, front lines, what a difference this medicine can make in the quality of their life and, in cases, the quality of their death. We work with the nurses, social workers, psychologists, doctors, et cetera, et cetera. When I approached nurses, their only request in legislation was that they be given some protections. In reading OMA, you'll see there are protections in OMA for doctors, but nurses are much more vulnerable than doctors. Ultimately, a nurse is responsible for a patient in residential care, for anything that happens to that patient, whether it be on the premises, whether it be their fault or not. So basically, the nurses are on the line criminally, civilly, and licensing for a medical marijuana patient using medical marijuana. And they have asked that that the legislative changes to the law include be included as part of what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't overemphasize the importance to nurses of this, because every time that they allow a patient to use medical marijuana, their jobs, their licensing, civilly and criminally, they're on the line. And so I can't overemphasize the importance. And law enforcement really didn't have a big objection to that. And then going back to the difficulty of finding care...
Wait. Law enforcement does not have...
Right. When we convened the Legislative Advisory Committee on your request, this was proposed. Law enforcement stated no objections to it. We proposed some other things, and they wanted quite a few modifications to the other things, like assisting a patient with medicating. Someone on his deathbed or a quadriplegic and medicating. They wanted it only to be done by someone whose job description included dispensing pharmaceuticals, and so we were okay with that, and they didn't really have a lot of problems with protections for nurses. However, in Dr. Higginson's proposed legislation, unfortunately, I think there was a transcription error, because what came out of that was protections for nurses for themselves being patients or caregivers, which I'm okay with that, but that wasn't the intent. The intent was protections for nurses from criminal, civil, or licensing repercussions.
Okay.
And then going back to the amendments here, it's really difficult for us to be recruiting caregivers. And I know I grow for myself and six other people, although I don't necessarily have that number of plants. We pool our medicine. But if... I was limited to only two people, myself being a patient, I could help only one other patient under this to maintain my affirmative defense. I wouldn't be willing to do that. My constitutional protections are very important to me. Now, helping patients, those in the most need, is also very important to me. But I couldn't give up my constitutional protections to do that. And these proposed changes for inspections would be requiring me to give up my constitutional protections. They're too important to me. My constitutional protections for unreasonable search, warrantless searches, right to privacy.
Okay.
I shouldn't have to give up my constitutional protections to help quadriplegics.
Okay. I guess under the current statute, then law enforcement has the right to... What do they have the right to do in terms of inspection?
They can get a search warrant, which is my constitutional protection.
But isn't that they can do it because you're a medical marijuana grower, because they have probable cause?
The law states specifically, because I'm a medical marijuana grower, it does not subject them to being able to come into my home and search my home.
So they need probable cause.
Correct. Just like any other crime. Okay. Probable cause and to get a search warrant. And, if someone's breaking the law and they have probable cause, then great.
We're not changing that, are we?
That is what is proposed by inspections. And Lieutenant Durbin would like to be able to just... If they hear some information, whether it be reliable or not,
to go and
demand to search a garden.
Okay, I raised the question of probable cause with him, and he's not here right now, but I would like to go back and revisit what he expects in terms of, I don't know, I mean, it just seems, if, okay, what constitutes probable cause? That's why we have courts, I guess, but I mean, if there is, in the mind of the law enforcement, if there are credible tips, or I guess, and they go to the judge and get a search warrant, they can do that with any individual.
Yes.
But they can't, under the current law, they cannot, you have the right to privacy under the current law, right?
Right, because you're a medical marijuana patient, in and of itself does not give them a right to search you.
Okay.
There's,
go ahead.
There's another thing that we have discussed in the Administrative Advisory Committee that was touched on. I just want to be really brief on this. Fired caregiver notifications. Sandy Burbank brought that up. It's something that we really need. If, for example, a patient could scam conceivably four or five different people to grow medicine for him, and only one of those would be protected.
That's kind of scary.
Right.
It's scary for growers,
especially as a caregiver. And last, and thanks for your patience, the patients that I work with in residential care have varying degrees of cognitive reasoning. Some have severe dementia. And it would be completely unreasonable for me to be expected, as that patient's caregiver who has severe dementia, to grow a year's supply of marijuana, 4 pounds or whatever, and hand that over to that patient as required by the current law that's being considered.
But it would be put under that patient's jurisdiction somehow. It would that's what we're getting at. I mean, there would have to be some way of getting it under, separated from the grower, I think. I don't know how we would do that, but there might be a repository, or there might be some place to put it. I mean, that's the intent.
So what we do is see every patient at least once a week, during which time we fill out a dispensing slip for the residential care facility's records and a follow-up slip detailing how well the medicine is or isn't working, for what conditions, what symptoms we're trying to target. A lot of times, some of these patients have such severe dementia, if you give them an ounce of marijuana, they will sit down and smoke the whole thing within an hour or two.
Yeah, I understand.
And that's not medical use.
Yeah.
But they don't have cognitive reasoning.
Okay.
What we have had to do in these instances is the patient will maintain possession of a lockbox, but the nursing staff will have possession of the key.
Okay.
On their medicine rounds, they give medicine rounds at various times. They'll hand the patient their key, and the patient can take a medical marijuana tincture capsule, for example, or a small packet of medicine to go and smoke. And that's how we've maintained some control. But again, what's being considered here is that the caregiver would be required, when he harvests the plant, to give the whole amount to the patient.
Well, I think
for this special type of patient, that.
Okay.
It's just not.
Well, what you're, as far as I'm concerned, you're pointing out new information that needs to be taken into consideration, and it sounds reasonable that it be in a lockbox, and if you're in an institution, and someone else would have control, just like any other substance that's dispensed. That to me would satisfy.
Well, unfortunately, the nursing staff would have a real problem with keeping 4 pounds of marijuana around.
Okay?
And so what we do is we hold on to it and, you know, pull the medicine and then dispense it in weekly allotments.
Well, okay. I really appreciate that. And I would also appreciate something in writing, as you know, I've been taking notes, but.
Right.
You know, because
I provided written testimony at the last work session.
Because it.
But unfortunately, I wasn't able to because I noticed I got this as I walked through the door today.
Okay.
So I'll be happy to submit some written testimony.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. And your situation is a unique situation. I mean, different than I've heard before. You know, I mean, there are a lot of variations of this caregiver. Mode. I mean, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your overtime this evening.
evening. My name is Alice. I'm from Lincoln County. I'm beginning my fourth year as an annual outdoor grower. I am concerned about a couple things. I'm going to make this real quick, and then if I may submit something in writing later that's a little more cohesive. I'm asking for reconsiderations in the following amounts. Okay. 12 mature plants annually and retaining the affirmative defense. I also do not wish to give up my legal rights.
Okay.
Another thing that's of main concern to me is that we need a consensus with all law enforcement around the state, okay, with application of OMA laws. As I understand it now, each county has carte blanche, basically, to decide and determine how they will interpret and apply the law. When I called DHS in the beginning, I was told to contact my local county district attorney for information on how OMA law was.
Now, tell me which county you're from.
Lincoln.
Okay.
I was told to call them. When I called back with concerns, because I have always been an outdoor grower, when I called back with concerns, because the moment I harvest my garden, I'm out of compliance. There is no way to remain in compliance and have a steady supply of medicine throughout the year. So I called DHS once again and asked them, how do I do this? How do I stay in compliance? I was told to have the plant removed from the dirt and hung upside down by the roots for the year, and it would still be considered a plant. Now I'm told that that's not correct. So I don't know what to do. So that's another concern of mine, is to have folks at DHS understand the law and be able to give consistent and concise answers that are correct and within the law.
And you will put those in writing?
I will certainly do so.
That will.
The other thing that I have to address is the inspections. I don't want that. I have grandchildren at my home. I don't want them subjected to that. I don't understand why someone needs to come in and inspect my garden. OMA now currently says that medical marijuana shall be considered the same as all other medicines. No one is showing up to inspect my medicine cabinet to make sure that I'm not giving that away or selling it or taking too much or too little. I don't see the difference here. I don't see a distinction. And that's all I have right now.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you very much. Okay. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Okay, Walter Hagen, Jerry Wade, and Stormy.
That's it?
Yeah.
That didn't clean up.
Yeah.
Smoke constitutional problem, I think.
No. I mean, just in terms of...
Oh, yeah. There's a lot.
No. I'm not talking about that. It's good. Good move.
Oh,
you got perspective there. Wow. You missed your calling. Why don't you put up with the play out of it?
Oh.
That's why you're doing that, Sean. I'm sorry. I have to. I was admiring my colleague's artwork, and now the camera is focusing. And I was suggesting that he put a special display up out on the in the galleria, and that I think then artwork while in committee. No, this is great. You're very talented.
That's a focusing thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Let's see. Okay. Well, Walter, do you want to start? It doesn't matter. Whoever. Okay, Jerry, you go.
Well, first off, I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Jerry Wade, and
Mike.
My name is Jerry Wade, and I'm the secretary for the Stormy Ray Foundation. I've been a call to herder in this program since 1999. And first of all, I'd like to say we're first started out talking about increasing plant limits, increasing the amount patients can have per plant or at all. But I think you hit a very important topic just a second before. And before we increase what the amount of plants being grown, I think that we need to make sure that the medicine being grown ends up with the patient that it's being intended for. And there are many people in this room that were behind me, and the activists have all taken a stance that marijuana that's being grown at the caregiver's house belongs to the caregiver, and the medicine that's being grown off those plants also belongs to the caregiver. In fact, they put in a legal document to the health department stating their position on this. In fact, the Stormy Ray Foundation requested from the Attorney General's office that they make a decision on whether who owns the medicine and plants that are being grown away from the patient's location. And they refused to make a suggestion on that. So your statement that the patients own the plant medicine is still a gray area in our law right now, and because of that, when a caregiver harvests the plants, there is nothing in the law that says he has to give that medicine to the patient. Nothing. If he decides to keep it, he can't sell it to anybody, but if he doesn't give it to the patient and the patient goes to the law enforcement say it's a civil matter, they can work it out in court, and there has not been determined yet whether the medicine even belongs to the patient that it's intended for. So I think before we, yes, there is definitely a need to increase the amounts of medicine that's being produced, or not grown. The number of plant number is generally sufficient. I just had a harvest of three plants, and I harvested 27 ounces of three plants. Now, those are indoor plants, and that is unusual. I consider myself a very good gardener. Mm-hmm. But the average medical marijuana plant is going to produce at least 3 to 4 ounces grown indoors. So if we set those numbers below that amount per plant, I disagree that we don't need to set a number per plant, because so much medicine is going to be grown for each one of those plants. And if you don't allow the patient to have and take that medicine, it goes somewhere else because it is being grown. If a caregiver harvests 17 ounces, right now the patient can have 1 ounce, and all of the rest of the medicine, the caregiver decides where it goes. And unfortunately, what's happening is the medicine is not ending up in the patient's hands. So whatever plant number or amount of medicine per plant you decide, I congratulate you. On the one-time annual year grow, at the end of the harvest, you said that all plants are harvested, all medicine that is produced is given to the patient, and that's the end. Well, I think on the year-round grows, it should be the same thing. When the plants are harvested for the patient, the medicine goes to the patient. Well, what we suggest in our bill is the patient should be able to designate where that medicine should be kept. Because there are instances, nursing homes, yeah, people that are unable to have that large amount, people with family, say you have children in the house and you don't want 4 pounds in your house that your children might have access to. Those situations, a patient could designate that the caregiver keep the medicine at that location. But other than those situations, the caregiver, the patient, the person who needs the medicine, who the medicine is being grown for, after it's harvested, there is no reason the medicine should not be in the hands of the patient who needs it. Right now, it is required to be left in the hands of a caregiver, somebody who has no medical need, and is much more likely, 3 months from now, when I go back and say, well, do you still have my medicine? It's not there anymore. And there's nothing the patient currently can do about it because it isn't even designated that the patient owns that medicine. So that's my chief concern is, yes, there needs to be increases in the amounts that can be kept from each plant because 1 ounce per plant is not what's realistic. That's not what's being harvested. But when that is harvested, it needs to go to the patient. And that's all I'd like to make sure that happens.
Okay, that's what we were trying to get at. Yeah, okay. Walter, you want to go next, or you want Stormy to go?
Yes, my name is Walter Hagen. I'm a chaplain for the Lower Columbia Blind Veterans Association. I'm also a patient on the medical marijuana program. And I've had quite a bit of difficulty trying to take care of my own gardens and everything else. And I kind of observed quite a few things that it's almost ludicrous. Here we're talking about something medical, that we don't have some kind of inspections that people come around and inspect, either state board of inspectors or something like that.
How many other production facilities for medicine are not inspected?
Okay, share the microphone.
And we're talking about health issues, right? It's okay. Something we're putting into our bodies.
Yeah.
There's no poisons, no chemicals. Mm-hmm.
So I
support Stormy, Jerry Ray and Stormy Ray.
Okay, okay.
Okay,
so can you clear this all up for us now, Stormy?
Yeah.
Oh, I hope so.
Yeah, okay. Because I want to hear what he supports.
He supports getting more medicine to the patient that needs.
Okay.
I think it is what Walter was trying to share with you guys. He has been terrific.
Would you identify yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Stormy Ray. I'm last on the list. Walter has been terrific at helping other patients that haven't maneuvered through the scope of getting their garden up and going, but still needed medicine. And so one of the things that I'm not hearing here, and I'm a little concerned about it, is the sharing. The spirit of OMA is for patients and cardholders to help each other. And what I'm hearing is a lot of lines going up, but not necessarily making OMA better for everybody who's part of it. I hear how we're going to go maybe down to 2 patients, 28 plants on one site. If you got one site that can handle 58 plants, please set as many patients with 7 plants as you can on that site. And if they're not going to be able to replant, if something happens, we've got problems galore. Because just like the indoor gardens, things happen, mm-hmm. and harvests don't make. If we had a bad lightning storm a couple of days before harvest, we probably are going to lose a big chunk of that medicine. There's still some more in-depth thinking that I hope that this committee gets to.
Okay. Now, are you saying then that an annual grow site of 28 or more plants one time only is not a viable?
It's not fair. If I take and pay electricity and I take care of a garden every single day so that I have a harvest, I'm only allowed to keep 3 ounces at a harvest, where I've worked like crazy for 4 months to make that harvest happen. So you're exposing the large gardens that could support many, many more patients without those electricity bills. And yet the ones that are paying and helping out so many right now are being hindered. Can we not have a system that's a little fair to everybody? Right now, my biggest problem is when a patient makes it to the point of harvest and they harvest, they're out of compliance. Why don't we have the affirmative defense protecting the people in the program when they harvest? Instead of the people that haven't even found the program or gone through any of the loops yet or up against any of the expenses that the gardens that are supporting so many patients right now are having to deal with. I'd like to see something a little fair.
Okay. Well, you have to understand.
Wait just a minute. Okay. That's why we have blanks in the amendment, because the reason we have the blanks is because we have not been able to deal with the amount that a patient is able to hold at one time and not be in violation of the law. Now, what I hear you saying is that affirmative defense then is what keeps you keeps you from breaking the law. Is that what you're saying?
Right now, day I harvest, tomorrow, I have to have the affirmative defense to protect my harvest until I can get it dried, get it divided, and get back in compliance with OMA.
We're not, I don't think we're talking about eliminating the affirmative defense on regular grow sites. It would only be, the thought would be on an annual one-time grow site that would be eliminated.
And that, again, you're giving some categories better overall civil right protection than you are others. If I choose to grow outside, then I don't have the protection that allows me, in other cases, to harvest and still have my medicine and be able to go to court and prove that I had the habit. If you can make it to where the affirmative defense isn't needed as much, and the only way that I can see doing that is to allow us to keep enough medicine that we have enough of a safety margin that we can harvest and not be out of compliance. And 3 ounces a plant, 7 plants, would give us a 21-ounce at any one time during the year without penalizing us, and give us then the safety net or the freedom to make medicine available to those that are coming into the program.
Okay, that's another point that we don't cover. When people first come into the program, they have to rely on
other patients
to share.
Yeah.
And we're not addressing, is that addressed in the current statute?
Our current law allows us to have 1 ounce per mature plant. The mature plant is going to produce more than 1 ounce if they're successful. And the law allows us to give that excess to other patients.
Okay.
And under the, there's three methods you can grow. You can grow, if you're growing every two rooms or running immature plants, you can harvest approximately every 2 months or 6 times a year. So the average patient's going to use 3 to 4 ounces of medicine a month, or 36 to 48 ounces a year. So whatever number you come up with has to allow the patient over the year's time to have that amount of medicine. So 6 harvests a year, divide up that 48 ounces over 6 harvests and figure out how much that is per plant. And the same way, if you're growing all 7 plants at one time, it takes around 4 months, or you can have 3 harvests a year. So again, those numbers need to add up, so that each way, whether you're growing once a year or 7 plants at a time or whatever, you get the same amount of medicine per year.
Okay. Without having different rights, depending on the program that you choose.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I would ask that the committee make our program stronger. Stronger for not just the patients that need it, that are on the program right now, but for patients that haven't even found this great program yet. Oregon is on the front line, and we're doing a terrific job. And so we're really counting on you guys to help us with this program, make it better. And thank you for all of your work.
Okay. Want it in writing.
You got it.
Well, I know, and I have your notebook.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's in there.
So. Yeah, but, and I understand that. I just wanted to be sure that we looked at the bigger picture, and I didn't want to just concentrate on what you were saying, and I know what you're saying, and I've got that. So if you have anything else that's not in your notebook, that's fine. But I just want to be sure. You know, we divide the users into several different categories, and you guys don't necessarily agree with each other, right? Okay.
One thing I can point out, or I did like the idea Grant Higgins suggested, is that the health department giving the authority to initiate inspections, where they can, basically, they have the right to arbitrate between patient and caregivers. If there's a problem, they can find out what the problem is, and if there's a whole bunch of problems coming out of one garden, then the health department can assign somebody to go over and look at
them. Okay, now that raises the question, the public health department is a benign neglect oversight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, they've got inspection services.
Okay, well, maybe I shouldn't have put it that benign neglect is pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
In all fairness, you know, they're I don't know that they're using any of the money from the fund to fund any of their agency. I don't know that. So if we are going to expect more involvement,
right.
I think there has to be an understanding, because, and that would be fee-based.
Yeah, we understand.
And so that way, if there are ideas for oversight, I'll use benign neglect again. I mean, without... Okay, what I'm saying is that I think there can be effective oversight that isn't perceived as abusive or whatever, you know, and I know that law enforcement, by their very presence, you know, has, mm-hmm. you know, can be overwhelming. To have someone come into your neighborhood, right. and your neighbors don't know anything about what you're doing, and suddenly there are the cops there doing things, and that could be disruptive. So I think it would be nice if there mm-hmm. could be some modification. Mm-hmm. And someone assigned to settle disputes and the kinds of things you're mentioning. That seems right. to make sense. Okay.
Senator Morissette, the only other thing that I would ask is that you put within the bill, however it comes out, that the ownership of the medicine and the plants belong to the registered patient.
Okay. I think we have that.
I don't think we've got it really clear if we mm-hmm. do.
We asked the Attorney General's office to make an opinion on that, and they came back and said they were unable to do it because the law is currently unclear.
Well, the law is...
Senator, we get into issues that, you know, if we're going to annual and they're going to have ownership, we haven't addressed that. We haven't addressed the scope of what that ownership would be and things like that. So, I mean, if they're going to have a year's supply, that's a lot of pot.
Yeah.
And this doesn't really specify that. So.
Okay. The law is also self-contradictory because one law says it's medicine and the other denies it as a class 2 medicine. So,
remember,
I mean,
the T-Vex we mentioned last time? They just approved it in Canada. It is on sale now for muscular sclerosis.
Okay. But not here.
One other quick question mm-hmm. for my own edification. I had a parent tell me about a child, a 21-year-old child who was diagnosed as a, I think it was, bipolar is what it was, and he was on medication, and he got off of his medication because of side effects, and he started smoking pot, illegally, he started smoking pot. But he said that helped more than any of the medication. Now, mm-hmm. that opens up another classification of
psychological
of illness that could be under there. And it's interesting. Now, I said to her, I said, I don't know what to say. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. Legally, I don't think that person would be eligible for...
In fact, there's many patients that are using it for that purpose but qualified under severe pain or some other category
okay.
but are currently using
well,
it.
Well, the thing that I think is probably the most important thing that could ever happen is the efficacy study of marijuana as a medicine and try to define the different strains of marijuana and how they affect different illnesses differently. I mean, that would be the ultimate, and then recognize that it is that. And go from, you know, we need to do that.
Well, for right now, Senator, let's try to fix the bill.
Yes, okay. Let's try to do that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And unless we, your other people, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 772.
Why don't you join the committee while you're at it?
And we, I thought we were going to stay around talking. Yeah. We'll adjourn the committee. Now we'll adjourn.